Blackstone Audio presents The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. For Tabitha King, promises to keep. Like many of the Mother Goose rhymes, the verse about the Tommyknockers is deceptively simple. The origin of the word is difficult to trace. Webster's Unabridged says Tommyknockers are either A. tunneling ogres, or B. ghosts which haunt deserted mines or caves. Because Tommy is an archaic British slang term referring to army rations, leading to the term Tommies as a word used to identify British conscripts, as in Kipling, it's Tommy this and Tommy that, the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary, while not identifying the term itself, at least suggests that Tommyknockers are the ghosts of miners who died of starvation, but still go knocking for food and rescue. The first verse, late last night and the night before, etc., is common enough for my wife and myself to have heard it as children, although we were raised in different towns, different faiths, and came from different descendants, hers primarily French, mine Scots-Irish. All other verses are products of the author's imagination. That author, me in other words, wishes to thank his spouse, Tabitha, who is an invaluable, if sometimes maddening, critic. If you get mad at critics, you almost always can be sure they are right. The editor, Alan Williams, for his kind and careful attention. Phyllis Gran, for her patience. This book was not so much written as gutted out. And in particular, George Everett McCutcheon, who has read each of my novels and vetted it carefully, primarily for weapons and ballistics reasons, but also for his attention to continuity. Mac died while this book was in rewrite. In fact, I was obediently making corrections suggested by one of his notes when I learned he had finally succumbed to the leukemia he had battled for nearly 2 years. I miss him terribly. Not because he helped me fix things, but because he was part of my heart's neighborhood. Thanks are due to others, more than I could name, pilots, dentists, geologists, fellow writers, even my kids, who listen to the book aloud. I'm also grateful to Stephen J. Gould. Although he is a Yankee fan, and thus not entirely to be trusted, his comments on the possibilities of what I'd call dumb evolution helped to shape the redraft of this novel, e.g. The Flamingo's Smile. Haven is not real. The characters are not real. This is a work of fiction. With one exception. The Tommyknockers are real. If you think I'm kidding, you miss the nightly news. Stephen King. Late last night and the night before, Tommyknockers, Tommyknockers, knocking at the door. I want to go out, don't know if I can, 'cause I'm so afraid of the Tommyknocker man. Traditional. Book 1. The Ship in the Earth. Chapter 1. Anderson Stumbles. 1. For want of a nail, the kingdom was lost. That's how the catechism goes when you boil it down. In the end, you can boil everything down to something similar, or so Roberta Anderson thought much later on. It's either all an accident or all fate. Anderson literally stumbled over her destiny in the small town of Haven, Maine, on June 21, 1988. That stumble was the root of the matter. All the rest was nothing but history. 2. Anderson was out that afternoon with Peter, an aging beagle who was now blind in one eye. Peter had been given to her by Jim Gardiner in 1976. Anderson had left college the year before with her degree only 2 months away to move onto her uncle's place in Haven. She hadn't realized how lonely she'd been until Gard brought the dog. He'd been a pup then, and Anderson sometimes found it difficult to believe he was now old, 84 in dog's years. It was a way of measuring her own age. 1976 had receded. Yes, indeed. When you were 25, you could still indulge in the luxury of believing that, in your case at least, growing up was a clerical error, which would eventually be rectified. When you woke up one day and discovered your dog was 84, and you yourself were 37, that was a view that had to be re-examined. Yes, indeed. Anderson was looking for a place to cut some wood. She'd a cord and a half laid by, but wanted at least another three to take her through the winter. She had cut a lot since those early days when Peter had been a pup, sharpening his teeth on an old slipper, and wetting all too often on the dining-room rug, but the place was still not short. The property, still, after 13 years, mostly referred to by the townspeople as the old Garrick place, had only 180 feet on Route 9, but the rock walls marking the north and south boundaries marched off at diverging angles. Another rock wall, this one so old it had degenerated into isolated rock middens furred with moss, marked the property's rear boundary about 3 miles into an unruly forest of first and second growth trees. The total acreage of this pie-shaped wedge was huge. Beyond the wall at the western edge of Bobby Anderson's land were miles of wilderness owned by the New England Paper Company. Burning woods on the map. In truth, Anderson didn't really need to hunt a place to do her cutting. The land her mother's brother had left her was valuable because most of the trees on it were good hardwood, relatively untouched by the gypsy moth infestation. But this day was lovely and warm. After a rainy spring, the garden was in the ground, where most of it would rot, thanks to the rains, and it wasn't yet time to start the new book. So she had covered the typewriter, and here she was with faithful old one-eyed Peter, rambling. There was an old logging road behind the farm, and she followed this almost a mile before striking off to the left. She was wearing a pack, a sandwich and a book in it for her, dog biscuits for Peter, and lots of orange ribbon to tie around the trunks of the trees she would want to cut as September's heat ebbed toward October, and a canteen. She had a silver compass in her pocket. She'd gotten lost on the property only once, and once was enough to last her forever. She had spent a terrible night in the woods, simultaneously unable to believe she had actually gotten lost on property she, for Christ's sweet sake, owned, and sure she would die out here. A possibility in those days, because only Jim would know she was missing, and Jim only came when you weren't expecting him. In the morning, Peter had led her to a stream, and the stream had led her back to Route 9, where it burbled cheerfully through a culvert, under the tar, only 2 miles from home. Nowadays, she probably had enough wood savvy to find her way back to the road, or to one of the rock walls bounding her land, but the key word was probably. So she carried a compass. She found a good stand of maple around 3 o'clock. In fact, she had found several other good stands of wood, but this one was close to a path she knew, a path wide enough to accommodate the tomcat. Come September 20th or so, if someone didn't blow the world up in the meantime, she would hook her sledge up to the tomcat, drive in here, and do some cutting. Besides, she had walked enough for one day. "Look good, Pete?" Pete barked feebly, and Anderson looked at the beagle with a sadness so deep it surprised and disquieted her. Peter was done up. He seldom took after birds and squirrels and chipmunks and the occasional woodchuck these days. The thought of Peter running a deer was laughable. She would have to take a good many rest stops on the way back for him, and there had been a time, not that long ago, or so her mind stubbornly maintained, when Peter would always have been a quarter of a mile ahead of her, belling volleys of barks back through the woods. She thought there might come a day when she would decide enough was enough. She'd pat the seat on the passenger side of the Chevrolet pickup for the last time and take Peter to the vet down in Augusta. But not this summer, please God. Or this fall or winter, please God. Or ever, please God. Because without Peter, she would be alone. Except for Jim. And Jim Gardner had gotten more than just a trifle wiggy over the last 8 years or so. Still a friend, but wiggy. "Glad you approve, Pete, old man," she said, putting a ribbon or two around the trees, knowing perfectly well she might decide to cut another stand and the ribbons would rot here. "Your taste is only exceeded by your good looks." Peter, knowing what was expected of him—he was old but not stupid—wagged his scraggy stub of a tail and barked. "Be a Viet Cong," Anderson ordered. Peter obediently fell on his side. A little wheeze escaped him, and rolled on his back, legs splayed out. That almost always amused Anderson. But today, the sight of her dog playing Viet Cong, Peter would also play dead at the words hooch or me lie, was too close to what she had been thinking about. "Up, Pete." Pete got up slowly, panting below his muzzle. his white muzzle. "Let's go back." She tossed him a dog biscuit. Peter snapped at it and missed. He snuffed for it, missed it, then came back to it. He ate it slowly, without much relish. "Right," Anderson said. "Move out." 3. For want of a shoe, the kingdom was lost. For the choice of a path, the ship was found. Anderson had been down here before in the 13 years that the Garrick place hadn't become the Anderson place. She recognized the slope of land, a deadfall left by pulpers who had probably all died before the Korean War, a great pine with a split top. She had walked this land before, and would have no trouble finding her way back to the path she would use with the tomcat. She might have passed the spot where she stumbled once or twice or half a dozen times before, perhaps by yards or feet or bare inches. This time she followed Peter as the dog moved slightly to the left, and with the path in sight one of her elderly hiking boots fetched up against something. Fetched up hard. "Hey!" she yelled, but it was too late, in spite of her pinwheeling arms. She fell to the ground. The branch of a low bush scratched her cheek hard enough to bring blood. "Shit!" she cried, and a blue jay scolded her. Peter returned, first sniffing and then licking her nose. "Christ, don't do that! Your breath stinks!" Peter wagged his tail. Anderson sat up. She rubbed her left cheek and saw blood on her palm and fingers. She grunted. "Nice going," she said, and looked to see what she had tripped over. A fallen piece of tree, most likely, or a rock poking out of the ground. Lots of rock in Maine. What she saw was a gleam of metal. She touched it, running her finger along it, and then blowing off black forest dirt. "What's this?" she asked Peter. Peter approached, sniffed at it, and then did a peculiar thing. The beagle backed off 2 dog paces, sat down, and uttered a single low howl. "Well, who got on your case?" Anderson asked, but Peter only sat there. Anderson hooked herself closer, still sitting down, sliding on the seat of her jeans. She examined the metal in the ground. Roughly 3 inches stuck out of the mulchy earth, just enough to trip over. There was a slight rise here, and perhaps the runoff from the heavy spring rains had freed it. Anderson's first thought was that the skidders who had logged this land in the 20s and 30s must have buried a bunch of their leavings here, the cast-off swill of a 3-day cutting, which in those days had been called a logger's weekend. A tin can, she thought, B&M beans or Campbell's soup. She wiggled it the way you'd wiggle a tin can out of the earth. Then it occurred to her that no one except a toddler would opt to trip over the leading edge of a can. The metal in the earth didn't wiggle. It was as solid as mother rock. A piece of old logging equipment, maybe? Intrigued, Anderson examined it more closely, not seeing that Peter had gotten to his feet, backed away another 4 paces, and sat down again. The metal was a dull gray, not the bright color of tin or iron at all. And it was thicker than a can, maybe a 1/4 inch at its top. Anderson placed the pad of her right index finger on this edge and felt a momentary odd tingling, like a vibration. She took her finger away and looked at it quizzically. Put it back. Nothing. No buzz. Now she pinched it between her thumb and finger and tried to draw it from the earth like a loose tooth from a gum. It didn't come. She was gripping the protrusion in the rough center. It sank back into the earth, or that was the impression she had then, on either side of a width of less than 2 inches. She would later tell Jim Gardner that she could have walked past it 3 times a day for 40 years and never stumbled over it. She brushed away loose soil, exposing a little more of it. She dug a channel along it about 2 inches deep with her fingers. The soil gave easily enough, as forest soil does, at least until you hit the webwork of roots. It continued smoothly down into the ground. Anderson got up on her knees and dug down along either side. She tried wiggling it again. Still no go. She scraped away more soil with her fingers and quickly exposed more. Now she saw 6 inches of gray metal, now 9, now 1 foot. "It's a car," or a truck or a skidder, she thought suddenly, buried out here in the middle of nowhere. Or maybe a Hooverville kind of stove. But why here? No reason that she could think of. No reason at all. She found things in the woods from time to time, shell casings, beer cans, the oldest not with pop-tops but with triangle-shaped holes made by what they had called a church key back in those dim, dead days of the 1960s, candy wrappers, other stuff. Haven was not on either of Maine's two major tourist tracks, one of which runs through the lake and mountain region to the extreme west of the state, and the other of which runs up the coast to the extreme east, but it had not been the forest primeval for a long, long time. Once, she had been over the decayed stone wall at the back of her land and actually trespassing on New England Paper Company's land at the time, she had found the rusted hulk of a late-40s Hudson Hornet standing in what had once been a woods road, and what was now, over 20 years after the cutting had stopped, a tangle of second growth, what the locals called shitwood. No reason that hulk of a car should have been there either. But it was easier to explain than a stove or a refrigerator or any other damn thing actually buried in the ground. She had dug twin trenches a foot long on either side of the object without finding its end. She got down almost a foot before scraping her fingers on rock. She might have been able to pull the rock out, that at least had some wiggle, but there was no reason to do it. The object in the earth continued down past it. Peter whined. Anderson glanced at the dog, then stood up. Both knees popped. Her left foot tingled with pins and needles. She fished her pocket watch out of her pants. Old and tarnished, the Simon watch was another part of her legacy from Uncle Frank, and was astonished to see that she had been here a long time. An hour and a quarter, at least. It was past 4. "Come on, Pete," she said. "Let's bug out." Peter whined again, but still wouldn't move. And now, with real concern, Anderson saw that her old beagle was shivering all over, as if with ague. She had no idea if dogs could catch ague, but thought old ones might. She did recollect that the only time she had ever seen Peter shiver like that was in the fall of 1977, or maybe it had been 78. There had been a catamount on the place. Over a series of perhaps 9 nights it had screamed and squalled, very likely in unrequited heat. Each night, Peter would go to the living room window and jump up on the old church pew Anderson kept there by her bookcase. He never barked. He only looked out into the dark, toward that unearthly, womanish squealing, nostrils flaring, ears up. And he shivered. Anderson stepped over her little excavation and went to Peter. She knelt down and ran her hands along the sides of Peter's face, feeling the shiver in her palms. "What's wrong, boy?" she murmured. But she knew what was wrong. Peter's good eyes shifted past her, toward the thing in the earth, and then back to Anderson. The plea in the eye, not veiled by the hateful milky cataract, was as clear as speech. "Let's get out of here, Bobby. I like that thing almost as much as I like your sister." "Okay," Anderson said uneasily. It suddenly occurred to her that she could not remember ever having lost track of time as she had today, out here. "Peter doesn't like it." "I don't either." "Come on." She started up the slope to the path. Peter followed with alacrity. They were almost to the path when Anderson, like Lot's wife, looked back. If not for that last glance, she might actually have let the whole thing go. Since leaving college before finals, in spite of her mother's tearful pleas and her sister's furious diatribes and baleful ultimatums, Anderson had gotten good at letting things go. The look back from this middle distance showed her 2 things. First, the thing did not sink back into the earth, as she had at first thought. The tongue of metal was sticking up in the middle of a fairly fresh declivity, not wide, but fairly deep, and surely the result of late winter runoff and the heavy spring rains that had followed it. So the ground to either side of the protruding metal was higher, and the metal simply disappeared back into it. Her first impression, that the thing in the ground was the corner of something, wasn't true after all, or not necessarily true. Second, it looked like a plate. Not a plate you'd eat from, but a dull metal plate, like metal siding or... Peter barked. Okay, Anderson said. I hear you talking. Let's go. Let's go, and let's let it go. She walked up the center of the path, letting Peter lead them back toward the woods road at his own bumbling pace, enjoying the lush green of high summer. And this was the first day of summer, wasn't it? The solstice? Longest day of the year? She slapped a mosquito and grinned. Summer was a good time in Haven, the best of times. And if Haven wasn't the best of places, parked as it was well above Augusta in that central part of the state most tourists passed by, it was still a good place to come to rest. There had been a time when Anderson had honestly believed she would only be here a few years, long enough to recover from the traumas of adolescence, her sister, and her abrupt, confused withdrawal, surrender, Anne called it, from college. But a few years had become 5, 5 had become 10, 10 had become 13, and look yare, Huck. Peter's old, and you got a pretty good crop of gray coming up in what used to be hair as black as the river Styx. She'd tried cropping it close 2 years ago, almost a punk do, had been horrified to find it made the gray even more noticeable, and had let it grow ever since. She now thought she might spend the rest of her life in Haven, with the sole exception of the duty trip she took to visit her publisher in New York every year or two. The town got you. The place got you. The land got you. And that wasn't so bad. It was as good as anything else, maybe. Like a plate. A metal plate. She broke off a short, limber branch, well-plumed with fresh green leaves, and waved it around her head. The mosquitoes had found her, and seemed determined to have their high tea off her. Mosquitoes whirling around her head, and thoughts like mosquitoes inside her head. Those she couldn't wave off. It vibrated under my finger for a second. I felt it, like a tuning fork. But when I touched it, it stopped. Is it possible for something to vibrate in the earth like that? Surely not. Maybe. Maybe it had been a psychic vibration. She did not absolutely disbelieve in such things. Maybe her mind had sensed something about that buried object, and had told her about it in the only way it could, by giving her a tactile impression, one of vibration. Peter had certainly sensed something about it. The old beagle hadn't wanted to go near it. Forget it. She did, for a little while. 4. That night, a high, mild wind arose, and Anderson went out on her front porch to smoke and listen to the wind walk and talk. At one time, even a year earlier, Peter would have come out with her, but now he remained in the parlor, curled up on his small hooked rug by the stove, nose to tail. Anderson found her mind replaying that last look back at the plate sticking out of the earth, and she later came to believe that there was a moment, perhaps when she flicked the cigarette into the gravel drive, when she decided she would have to dig it up and see what it was, although she didn't consciously recognize the decision then. Her mind worried restlessly at what it might be, and this time she allowed it to run. She had learned that if your mind insisted on returning to a topic, no matter how you tried to divert it, it was best to let it return. Only obsessives worried about obsession. Part of some building, her mind hazarded, a prefab. But no one built Quonset huts out in the woods. Why drag all that metal in when 3 men could throw up a cutter's lean-to with saws, axes, and a 2-handed bucksaw in 6 hours? Not a car, either, or the protruding metal would have been flaked with rust. An engine block seemed slightly more likely, but why? And now, with dark drawing down, that memory of vibration returned, with inarguable certainty. It must have been a psychic vibration. If she had felt it at all, it... Suddenly a cold and terrible certainty rose in her. Someone was buried there. Maybe she had uncovered the leading edge of a car or an old refrigerator or even some sort of steel trunk. But whatever it had been in its above-ground life, it was now a coffin. A murder victim? Who else would be buried in such a way, in such a box? Guys who happened to wander into the woods during hunting season and got lost there and died there didn't carry along metal caskets to pop themselves into when they died. And even given such an idiotic idea, who would shovel the dirt back in? Cut me a break, folks, as we used to say back in the glorious days of our youth. The vibration. It had been the call of human bones. Come on, Bobby. Don't be so fucking stupid. A shudder worked through her, nevertheless. The idea had a certain weird persuasiveness, like a Victorian ghost story that had no business working as the world hurtled down Microchip Alley toward the unknown wonders and horrors of the 21st century, but somehow produced the goose flesh just the same. She could hear Anne laughing and saying, "You're getting as funny in the head as Uncle Frank, Bobby, and it's just what you deserve, living out there alone with your smelly dog." Sure, cabin fever. The hermit complex. Call the doctor, call the nurse. Bobby's bad and getting worse. All the same, she suddenly wanted to talk to Jim Gardner. Needed to talk to him. She went in to call his place up the road in Unity. She had dialed four numbers when she remembered he was off doing readings. Those and the poetry workshops were the way he supported himself. For itinerant artists, summer was prime time. "All those menopausal matrons have to do something with their summers," she could hear Jim saying ironically. "And I have to eat in the winter. One hand washes the other. You ought to thank God you're saved the reading circuit anyway, Bobby." Yes, she was saved that, although she thought Jim liked it more than he let on. Certainly did get laid enough. Anderson put the phone back in the cradle and looked at the bookcase to the left of the stove. It wasn't a handsome bookcase. She was no one's carpenter, nor ever would be, but it served the purpose. The bottom two shelves were taken up by the Time Life series of volumes on the Old West. The two shelves above were filled with a mixture of fiction and fact on that same subject. Brian Garfield's early westerns jostled for place with Hubert Hampton's massive Western Territories examined. Louis L'Amour's Sackett saga lay cheek by jowl with Richard Marius's wonderful two novels, The Coming of Rain and Bound for the Promised Land. J.R. Nash's Bloodletters and Bad Men, and Richard F.K. Mudgett's Westward Expansion bracketed a riot of paperback westerns by Ray Hogan, Archie Jocelyn, Max Brand, Ernest Haycox, and, of course, Zane Grey. Anderson's copy of Riders of the Purple Sage had been read nearly to tatters. On the top shelf were her own books, 11 of them. 10 were westerns, beginning with Hangtown, published in 1975. And ending with The Long Ride Back, published in 86. Massacre Canyon, the new one, would be published in September, as all of her westerns had been since the beginning. It occurred to her now that she had been here, in Haven, when she had received her first copy of Hangtown, although she'd begun the novel in the room of a scuzzy Cleves Mills apartment on a 30s vintage Underwood dying of old age. Still, she'd finished here. And it was here that she'd held the first actual copy of the book in her hands. Here, in Haven. Her entire career as a publishing writer was here. Except for the first book. She took that down now and looked at it curiously, realizing it had been perhaps 5 years since she had held this slim volume in her hands. It was not only depressing to realize how fast time got by, it was depressing to think how often she thought about that lately. This volume was a total contrast to the others, with their jackets showing maces and buttes, riders and cows, and dusty trail-drive towns. This jacket was a 19th-century woodcut of a clipper ship, quartering toward land. Its uncompromising blacks and whites were startling, almost shocking. "Boxing the Compass" was the title printed above the woodcut, and below it, "Poems" by Roberta Anderson. She opened the book, paging past the title, musing for a moment over the copyright date, 1974, then pausing at the dedication page. It was as stark as the woodcut. "This book is for James Gardner." The man she had been trying to call. The second of the only three men she had ever had sex with, and the only one who had ever been able to bring her to orgasm. Not that she attached any special importance to that. Or not much, anyway. Or so she thought. Or thought she thought. Or something. And it didn't matter, anyway. Those days were also old days. She sighed and put the book back on the shelf without looking at the poems. Only one of them was much good. That one had been written in March of 1972, a month after her grandfather died of cancer. The rest of them were crap. The casual reader might have been fooled because she was a talented writer, but the heart of her talent had been somewhere else. When she had published Hangtown, the circle of writers she had known had all denied her, all except Jim, who had published Boxing the Compass in the first place. She had dropped Sherry Fenderson a long, chatty letter not long after coming to Haven, and had received a curt postcard in return. "Please don't write me any more. I don't know you." Signed with a single slashed S, as curt as the message. She had been sitting on the porch, crying over that card, when Jim showed up. "Why are you crying over what that silly woman thinks?" he had asked her. "Do you really want to trust the judgment of a woman who goes around yelling, 'Power to the people,' and smelling of Chanel No. 5? "She just happens to be a very good poet," she had sniffled. Jim gestured impatiently. "That doesn't make her any older," he had said, "or any more able to recant the cant she's been taught and then taught herself. Get your mind right, Bobby. If you want to go on doing what you like, get your fucking mind right and stop that fucking crying. That fucking crying makes me sick. That fucking crying makes me want to puke. You're not weak. I know weak when I'm with it. Why do you want to be something you're not? Your sister? Is that why? She's not here, and she's not you, and you don't have to let her in if you don't want to. Don't whine to me about your sister anymore. Grow up. Stop bitching." She'd looked at him, she remembered now, amazed. "There's a big difference between being good at what you do and being smart about what you know," he said. "Give Sherry some time to grow up. Give yourself some time to grow up. And stop being your own jury. It's boring. I don't want to listen to you snivel. Sniveling is for jerks. Quit being a jerk." She had felt herself hating him, loving him, wanting all of him and none of him. Did he say he knew weak when he was with it? Boy, he ought to. He was bent. She knew it even then. "Now," he had said, "you want to lay an ex-publisher, or do you want to cry all over that stupid postcard?" She had laid him. She didn't know now, and hadn't known then if she wanted to lay him, but she had, and screamed when she came. That had been near the end. She remembered that, too, how it had been near the end. He had gotten married not long after, but it would have been near the end anyway. He was weak, and he was bent. "Doesn't matter anyway," she thought, and gave herself the old good advice. "Let it go." Advice easier given than followed. It was a long time before Anderson got over into sleep that night. Old ghosts had stirred when she moved her book of undergraduate poems. Or perhaps it was that high, mild wind hooting the eaves and whistling the trees. She had almost made it when Peter woke her up. Peter was howling in his sleep. Anderson got up in a hurry, scared. Peter had made a lot of noises in his sleep before this, not to mention some unbelievably noxious dog farts, but he had never howled. It was like waking to the sound of a child screaming in the grip of a nightmare. She went into the living room, naked except for her socks, and knelt by Peter, who was still on the rug by the stove. "Pete," she muttered. "Hey, Pete, cool it." She stroked the dog. Peter was shivering and jerked away when Anderson touched him, baring the eroded remains of his teeth. Then his eyes opened, the bad one and the good one, and he seemed to come back to himself. He whined weakly and thumped his tail against the floor. "You all right?" Anderson asked. Peter licked her hand. "Then lie down again. Stop whining. It's boring. Stop fucking off." Peter lay down and closed his eyes. Anderson knelt, looking at him, troubled. "He's dreaming of that thing." Her rational mind rejected that, but the night insisted on its own imperative. It was true, and she knew it. She went to bed at last, and sleep came sometime after 2 in the morning. She had a peculiar dream. In it she was groping in the dark, not trying to find something, but to get away from something. She was in the woods. Branches whipped into her face and poked her arms. Sometimes she stumbled over roots and fallen trees. And then, ahead of her, a terrible green light shone out in a single pencil-like ray. In her dream, she thought of Poe's The Telltale Heart, the mad narrator's lantern, muffled up except for one tiny hole, which he used to direct a beam of light onto the evil eye he fancied his elderly benefactor possessed. Bobby Anderson felt her teeth fall out. They went painlessly, all of them. The bottom ones tumbled, some outward, some back into her mouth, where they lay on her tongue or under it in hard little lumps. The top one simply dropped down the front of her blouse. She felt one catch in her bra, which clasped in front, poking her skin. The light, the green light, the light. 5. Was wrong. It wasn't just that it was gray and pearly, that light. It was expected that such a wind as had blown up the night before would bring a change in the weather. But Anderson knew there was something more than that wrong, even before she looked at the clock on the nightstand. She picked it up in both hands and drew it close to her face, although her vision was a perfect 20/20. It was 3:15 in the afternoon. She had gone to sleep late, given, but no matter how late she slept, either habit or the need to urinate always woke her up by 9 o'clock, 10 at the latest. But she had slept a full 12 hours. And she was ravenous. She shuffled out into the living room, still wearing only her socks, and saw that Peter was lying limply on his side, head back, yellow stubs of teeth showing, legs splayed out. Dead, she thought with a cold and absolute certainty. Peter's dead. Died in the night. She went to her dog, already anticipating the feel of cold flesh and lifeless fur. Then Peter uttered a muzzy, lip-flapping sound, a blurry dog snore. Anderson felt huge relief course through her. She spoke the dog's name aloud, and Peter started up, almost guiltily, as if he was also aware of oversleeping. Anderson supposed he was. Dogs seemed to have an acutely developed sense of time. "We slept late, fella," she said. Peter got up and stretched first one hind leg and then the other. He looked around, almost comically perplexed, and then went to the door. Anderson opened it. Peter stood there for a moment, not liking the rain. Then he went out to do his business. Anderson stood in the living room a moment longer, still marveling over her certainty that Peter had been dead. Just what in hell was wrong with her lately? Everything was doom and gloom. Then she headed for the kitchen to fix a meal, whatever you called breakfast at 3 in the afternoon. On the way, she diverted into the bathroom to do her own business. Then she paused in front of her reflection in the toothpaste-spotted mirror. A woman pushing 40. Graying hair, otherwise not too bad. She didn't drink much, didn't smoke much. Spent most of her time outside when she wasn't writing. Irish black hair, no romance novel blaze of red for her, rather too long. Gray-blue eyes. Abruptly, she bared her teeth, expecting for just a moment to see only smooth pink gums. But her teeth were there, all of them. Thank the fluoridated water in Utica, New York, for that. She touched them, let her fingers prove their bony reality to her brain. But something wasn't right. Wetness. There was wetness on her upper thighs. Oh, no. Oh, shit. This is almost a week early. I just put clean sheets on the bed yesterday. But after she had showered, put a pad and a fresh pair of cotton panties and pulled the whole works snug, she checked the sheets and saw them unmarked. Her period was early, but it had at least had the consideration to wait until she was almost awake. And there was no cause for alarm. She was fairly regular, but she had been both early and late from time to time. Maybe diet, maybe subconscious stress, maybe some internal clock slipping a cog or two. She had no urge to grow old fast, but she often thought that having the whole inconvenient business of menstruation behind her would be a relief. The last of her nightmares slipped away, and Bobby Anderson went in to fix herself a very late breakfast. Chapter 2. Anderson Digs. 1. It rained steadily for the next 3 days. Anderson wandered restlessly around the house, made a trip with Peter into Augusta in the pickup for supplies she didn't really need, drank beer, and listened to old Beach Boys tunes while she made repairs around the house. Trouble was, there weren't really that many repairs that needed to be done. By the third day, she was circling the typewriter, thinking maybe she would start the new book. She knew what it was supposed to be about, a young schoolmarm and a buffalo hunter caught up in a range war in Kansas during the early 1850s, a period when everyone in the midsection of the country seemed to be tuning up for the Civil War, whether they knew it or not. It would be a good book, she thought, but she didn't think it was quite ready yet, whatever that meant. A sardonic mimic awoke in her mind, doing an Orson Welles voice, "We will write no Ota before its time." Still, her restlessness dug at her, and the signs were all there, an impatience with books, with the music, with herself, a tendency to drift off, and then she would be looking at the typewriter, wanting to wake it into some dream. Peter also seemed restless, scratching at the door to go out, and then scratching at it to come back in 5 minutes later, wandering around the place, lying down, then getting up again. "Low barometer," Anderson thought. "That's all it is. Makes us both restless, cranky." And her damned period. Usually she flowed heavy and then just stopped, like turning off a faucet. This time she just went on leaking. "Bad washer, ha ha," she thought, with no humor at all. She found herself sitting in front of the typewriter just after dark on the second rainy day, a blank sheet rolled into the carriage. She started to type, and what came out was a bunch of X's and O's, like a kid's tic-tac-toe game, and then something that looked like a mathematical equation, which was stupid since the last math she'd taken was Algebra 2 in high school. These days X was for crossing out the wrong word, and that was all. She pulled the blank sheet out and tossed it away. After lunch on the third rainy day, she called the English department at the university. Jim no longer taught there, not for 8 years, but he still had friends on the faculty and kept in touch. Muriel in the office usually knew where he was, and did this time. Jim Gardner, she told Anderson, was doing a reading in Fall River that night, June 24th, followed by two in Boston over the next 3 nights, followed by readings and lectures in Providence and New Haven, all part of something called the New England Poetry Caravan. Must be Patricia McCardle, Anderson thought, smiling a little. So he'd be back, when, 4th of July? "Gee, I don't know when he'll be back, Bobby," Muriel said. "You know Jim. His last reading's June 30th. That's all I can say for sure." Anderson thanked her and hung up. She looked at the phone thoughtfully, calling up Muriel fully in her mind. Another Irish Colleen, but Muriel had the expected red hair, just now reaching the far edge of her prime, round-faced, green-eyed, full-breasted. Had she slept with Jim? Probably. Anderson felt a spark of jealousy, but not much of a spark. Muriel was okay. Just speaking to Muriel made her feel better. Someone who knew who she was, who could think of her as a real person, not just as a customer on the other side of the counter in an Augusta hardware store, or as someone to say how do to over the mailbox. She was solitary by nature, but not monastic, and sometimes simple human contact had a way of fulfilling her when she didn't even know she needed to be fulfilled. And she supposed she knew now why she had wanted to get in contact with Jim. Talking with Muriel had done that, at least. The thing in the woods had stayed on her mind, and the idea that it was some sort of clandestine coffin had grown to a certainty. It wasn't writing she was restless to do, it was digging. She just hadn't wanted to do it on her own. "Looks like I'll have to, though, Pete," she said, sitting down in her rocker by the east window, her reading chair. Peter glanced at her briefly, as if to say, "Whatever you want, babe." Anderson sat forward, suddenly looking at Pete, really looking at him. Peter looked back cheerfully enough, tail thumping on the floor. For a moment it seemed there was something different about Peter, something so obvious she should be seeing it. If so, she wasn't. She settled back, opening her book, a master's thesis from the University of Nebraska, the most exciting thing about it, the title, Range War and Civil War. She remembered thinking a couple of nights ago, as her sister Anne would think, "You're getting as funny in the head as Uncle Frank, Bobby." Well, maybe. Shortly, she was deep into the thesis, making an occasional note on the legal pad she kept near. Outside, the rain continued to fall. 2. The following day dawned clear and bright and flawless, a postcard summer day with just enough breeze to make the bugs keep their distance. Anderson pottered around the house until almost 10 o'clock, conscious of the growing pressure her mind was putting on her to get out there and dig it up already. She could feel herself consciously pushing back against that urge. Orson Welles again. "We will dig up nobody before it's..." "Oh, shut up, Orson." Her days of simply following the urge of the moment, a lifestyle that had once been catechized by the bald motto, "If it feels good, do it," were over. It had never worked well for her, that philosophy. In fact, almost every bad thing that had happened to her had its roots in some impulsive action. She attached no moral stigma to people who did live their lives according to that impulse. Maybe her intuitions just hadn't been that good. She ate a big breakfast, added a scrambled egg to Peter's gravy train. Peter ate with more appetite than usual, and Anderson put it down to the end of the rainy spell, and then did the washing up. If her dribbles would just stop, everything would be fine. "Forget it. We will stop no period before it's time. Right, Orson? You're fucking A." Bobby went outside, clapped an old straw cowboy hat on her head, and spent the next hour in the garden. Things out there were looking better than they had any right to, given the rain. The peas were coming on, and the corn was rearing up good, as Uncle Frank would have said. She quit at 11. Fuck it. She went around the house to the shed, got the spade and shovel, paused, and added a crowbar. She started out of the shed, went back, and took a screwdriver and an adjustable wrench from the toolbox. Peter started out with her, as he always did, but this time Anderson said, "No, Peter," and pointed back at the house. Peter stopped, looking wounded. He whined and took a tentative step toward Anderson. "No, Peter." Peter gave in and headed back, head down, tail drooping dispiritedly. Anderson was sorry to see him go that way, but Peter's previous reaction to the plate in the ground had been bad. She stood a moment longer on the path which would lead her to the woods road, spade in one hand, shovel and crowbar in the other, watching as Peter mounted the back steps, nosed open the back door, and went into the house. She thought, something was different about him. Is different about him. What is it? She didn't know. But for a moment, almost subliminally, her dream flickered back to her, that arrow of poisonous green light, and her teeth all falling painlessly out of her gums. Then it was gone, and she set off toward the place where it was, that odd thing in the ground, listening to the crickets make their steady re-re-re sound in this small back field, which would soon be ready for its first cutting. 3. At 3 that afternoon, it was Peter who raised her from the semi-daze in which she had been working, making her aware she was two damn nears, damn near starving and damn near exhausted. Peter was howling. The sound raised goose flesh on Anderson's back and arms. She dropped the shovel she had been using and backed away from the thing in the earth, the thing that was no plate, no box, not anything she could understand. All she knew for sure was that she had fallen into a strange, thoughtless state she didn't like at all. This time she had done more than lose track of time. She felt as if she had lost track of herself. It was as if someone else had stepped into her head, the way a man would step into a bulldozer or a payloader, simply firing her up and starting to yank the right levers. Peter howled, nose pointing toward the sky. Long, chilling, mournful sounds. "Stop it, Peter!" Anderson yelled. And thankfully Peter did. Any more of that and she might simply have turned and run. Instead, she fought for control and got it. She backed up another step and cried out when something flapped loosely against her back. At her cry, Peter uttered one more short, yipping sound and fell silent again. Anderson grabbed for whatever had touched her, thinking it might be... Well, she didn't know what she thought it might be, but even before her hand closed on it, she remembered what it was. She had a hazy memory of stopping just long enough to hang her blouse on a bush. Here it was. She took it and put it on, getting the buttons wrong on the first try so that one tail hung down below the other. She rebuttoned it, looking at the dig she had begun. And now that archaeological word seemed to fit what she was doing exactly. Her memories of the 4.5 hours she'd spent digging were like her memory of hanging her blouse on the bush, hazy and broken. They were not memories, they were fragments. But now, looking at what she had done, she felt awe as well as fear, and a mounting sense of excitement. Whatever it was huge, not just big, but huge. The spade, shovel, and crowbar lay at intervals along a 15-foot trench in the forest floor. She had made neat piles of black earth and chunks of rock at regular intervals. Sticking up from this trench, which was about 4 feet deep at the point where Anderson had originally stumbled over 3 inches of protruding gray metal, was the leading edge of some titanic object. Gray metal. Some object. You'd ordinarily have a right to expect something better, more specific, from a writer, she thought, arming sweat from her forehead. But she was no longer sure the metal was steel. She thought now it might be some more exotic alloy, beryllium, magnesium, perhaps. And composition aside, she had absolutely no idea what it was. She began to unbutton her jeans so she could tuck in her blouse, then paused. The crotch of the faded Levi's was soaked with blood. Jesus, Jesus Christ! This isn't a period. This is Niagara Falls. She was momentarily frightened, really frightened, then told herself to quit being a ninny. She had gone into some sort of daze and done digging a crew of 4 husky men could have been proud of. Her, a woman who went 125, maybe 130 tops. Of course she was flowing heavily. She was fine. In fact, she'd be grateful she wasn't cramping as well as gushing. "My, how poetic we are today, Bobby," she thought, and uttered a harsh little laugh. All she really needed was to clean herself up. A shower and a change would do fine. The jeans had been ready for either the trash or the rag bag anyway. Now there was one less worry in a troubled, confusing world, right? Right. No big deal. She buttoned her pants again, not tucking the blouse in. No sense ruining that as well. Although God knew it wasn't exactly a Dior original. The feel of the sticky wetness down there when she moved made her grimace. God, she wanted to get cleaned up. In a hurry. But instead of starting up the slope to the path, she walked back toward the thing in the earth, again driven to it. Peter howled, and the goose flesh reappeared again. "Peter, will you for Christ's sake shut up?" She hardly ever shouted at Pete, really shouted at him, but the goddamn mutt was starting to make her feel like a behavioral psychology subject. Goose flesh when the dog howled instead of saliva at the sound of the bell. But the same principle. Standing close to her find, she forgot about Peter and only stared wonderingly at it. After some moments, she reached out and gripped it. Again, she felt that curious sense of vibration. It sank into her hand and then disappeared. This time, she thought of touching a hull, beneath which very heavy machinery is hard at work. The metal itself was so smooth that it had an almost greasy texture. You expected some of it to come off on your hands. She made a fist and wrapped her knuckles on it. It made a dull sound, like a fist rapping on a thick chunk of mahogany. She stood a moment longer, then took the screwdriver from her back pocket, held it indecisively for a moment, and then, feeling oddly guilty, feeling like a vandal, she drew the blade down the exposed metal. It wouldn't scratch. Her eyes suggested 2 further things, but either or both could have been an optical illusion. The first was that the metal seemed to grow slightly thicker as it went from its edge to the point where it disappeared into the earth. The second was that the edge was slightly curved. These 2 things, if true, suggested an idea that was at once exciting, ludicrous, frightening, impossible, and possessed of a certain mad logic. She ran her palm over the smooth metal, then stepped away. What the hell was she doing petting this goddamn thing while the blood was running down her legs? and her period was the least of her concerns if what she was starting to think just might turn out to be the truth. You better call somebody, Bobby, right now. I'll call Jim when he gets back. Sure, call a poet. Great idea. Then you can call the Reverend Moon, maybe Edward Gorey and Gay and Wilson to draw pictures. Then you can hire a few rock bands and have fucking Woodstock 1988 out here. Get serious, Bobby. Call the state police. No, I want to talk to Jim first. Want him to see it. Want to talk to him about it. Meantime, I'll dig around it some more. It could be dangerous. Yes, not only could be, probably was. Hadn't she felt that? Hadn't Peter felt it? There was something else, too. Coming down the slope from the path this morning, she had found a dead woodchuck, had almost stepped on it. Although the smell when she bent over the animal told her it had been dead 2 days at least, there had been no buzz of flies to warn her. There were no flies at all around old Chuck, and Anderson could not remember ever having seen such a thing. There was no obvious sign of what had killed it, either, but believing that the thing in the ground had had anything to do with it was bullshit of the purest ray serene. Old Chuck had probably gotten some farmer's poison bait and stumbled out here to die. Go home. Change your pants. You're bloody and you stink. She backed away from the thing, then turned and climbed the slope back to the path where Peter jumped clumsily on her and began to lick her hand with an eagerness that was a little pathetic. Even a year ago he would have been trying to nose at her crotch, attracted by the smell there, but not now. Now all he could do was shiver. "Your own damn fault," Anderson said. "I told you to stay home." All the same, she was glad Peter had come. If he hadn't, Anderson might have worked right through until nightfall, and the idea of coming to in the dark with that thing bulking close by, that idea didn't fetch her. She looked back from the path. The height gave her a more complete view of the thing. It jutted from the ground at a slight angle, she saw. Her impression that the leading edge had a slight curve recurred. A plate. That's what I thought when I first dug around it with my fingers. A steel plate, not a dinner plate, I thought, but maybe even then, with so little of it sticking out of the ground, it was really a dinner plate I was thinking of. Or a saucer. A flying fucking saucer. 4. Back at the house, she showered and changed, using one of the maxi pads, even though the heavy menstrual flow already appeared to be lessening. Then she fixed herself a huge supper of canned baked beans and knockwurst. But she found herself too tired to do much more than pick at it. She put the remains, more than half, down for Peter, and went over to her rocker by the window. The thesis she had been reading was still on the floor beside the chair, her place marked with a torn-off matchbook cover. Her notepad was beside it. She picked it up, turned to a fresh page, and began to sketch the thing in the woods as she had seen it when she took that last look back. She was no great shakes with a pen unless it was words she was making, but she had some small sketching talent. This sketch went very slowly, however, not just because she wanted it to be as exact as she could make it, but because she was so tired. To make matters worse, Peter came over and nuzzled her hand, wanting to be patted. She stroked Peter's head absently, erasing a jag his nose had put into the horizon line of her sketch. "Yeah, you're a good dog, great dog. Go check the mail, why don't you?" Peter trotted across the living room and nosed the screen door open. Anderson went back to work on her sketch, glancing up once to see Peter do his world-famous canine male retrieval trick. He put his left forepaw up on the mailbox post and then began to swipe at the door of the box. Joe Paulson, the postman, knew about Peter and always left it ajar. He got the door down, then lost his balance before he could hook the mail out with his paw. Anderson winced a little. Until this year, Peter had never lost his balance. Getting the mail had been his pièce de résistance, better than playing dead Viet Cong, and much better than anything mundane like sitting up or speaking for a dog biscuit. It wowed everyone who saw him do it, and Peter knew it. But these days it was a painful ritual to watch. It made Anderson feel the way she imagined she would feel if she saw Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers as they were now, trying to do one of their old dance routines. The dog managed to get up on the post again, and this time Peter hooked the mail. A catalog and a letter, or bill, yes, with the end of the month coming, it was more likely a bill, out of the box with the first swipe of his paw. It fluttered to the road, and as Peter picked it up, Anderson dropped her eyes back to her sketch, telling herself to stop banging the goddamn funeral bell for Peter every 2 minutes. The dog actually looked half alive tonight. There had been nights recently when he'd had to totter up on his hind legs 3 or 4 times before he was able to get his mail, which usually came to no more than a free sample from Procter & Gamble or an advertising circular from Kmart. Anderson stared at her sketch closely, absently shading in the trunk of the big pine tree with a split top. It wasn't 100% accurate, but it was pretty close. She'd gotten the angle of the thing right, anyway. She drew a box around it, then turned the box into a cube, as if to isolate the thing. The curve was obvious enough in her sketch, but had it really been there? Yes. And what was she calling a metal plate? It was really a hull, wasn't it? A glassy, smooth, rivetless hull. You're losing your mind, Bobby. You know that, don't you? Peter scratched on the screen to be let in. Anderson went to the door, still looking at her sketch. Peter came in and dropped the mail on a chair in the hallway. Then he walked slowly down to the kitchen, presumably to see if there was anything he had overlooked on Anderson's plate. Anderson picked up the 2 pieces of mail and wiped them on the leg of her jeans with a little grimace of disgust. It was a good trick, granted, but dog spit on the mail was never going to be one of her favorite things. The catalog was from Radio Shack. They wanted to sell her a word processor. The bill was from Central Maine Power. That made her think briefly of Jim Gardner again. She tossed both on the table in the hall, went back to her chair, sat down again, flipped to a fresh page, and quickly copied her original sketch. She frowned at the mild arc, which was probably a bit of extrapolation, as if she had dug down maybe 12 or 14 feet instead of just 4. Well, so what? A little extrapolation didn't bother her. Hell, that was part of a fiction writer's business, and people who thought it belonged solely to science fiction or fantasy writers had never looked through the other end of the telescope, had never been faced with the problem of filling in white spaces that no history could provide. Things like what had happened to the people who had colonized Roanoke Island off the North Carolina coast, and then simply disappeared, for example, leaving no mark but the inexplicable word Croatoan, carved on a tree. Or the Easter Island monoliths, or why the citizens of a little town in Utah called Blessing had all suddenly gone crazy, or so it seemed, on the same day in the summer of 1884. If you didn't know for sure, it was okay to imagine, until and unless you found out different. There was a formula by which circumference could be determined from an arc. She was quite sure of it. She had forgotten what the damn thing was. That was the only problem. But she could maybe get a rough idea, always assuming her impression of just how much the thing's edge curved was accurate, by estimating the thing's center point. Bobby went back to the hall table and opened its middle drawer, which was a sort of catch-all. She rooted past untidy bundles of canceled checks, dead CD and 9-volt batteries. For some reason, she had never been able to shit-can old batteries. What you did with old batteries was throw them in a drawer, God knew why. It was just the battery graveyard instead of the one the elephants were supposed to have. Bunches of rubber bands and wide red canning rubbers, unanswered fan letters, she could no more throw out an unanswered fan letter than a dead battery, and recipes jotted on file cards. At the very bottom of the drawer was a litter of small tools, and among them she found what she was looking for, a compass with a yellow stub of pencil sleeved into the armature. Sitting in the rocker again, Anderson turned to a fresh sheet and drew the leading edge of the thing in the earth for the third time. She tried to keep it in scale, but drew it a little bigger this time, not bothering with the surrounding trees and only suggesting the trench for the sake of perspective. "Okay, guesswork," she said, and dug the point of the compass into the yellow legal pad below the curved edge. She adjusted the compass's arc so it traced that edge fairly accurately, and then she swept the compass around in a complete circle. She looked at it, then wiped her mouth with the heel of her hand. Her lips suddenly felt too loose and too wet. "Bullshit," she whispered. but it wasn't Boole's sheet. Unless her estimate of the edge's curvature and of midpoint were both wildly off the beam, she had unearthed the edge of an object which was at least 300 yards in circumference. Anderson dropped the compass and the pad on the floor and looked out the window. Her heart was beating too hard. 5. As the sun went down, Anderson sat on her back porch, staring across her garden toward the woods, and listened to the voices in her head. In her junior year at college, she had taken a psychology department seminar on creativity. She had been amazed, and a little relieved, to discover that she was not concealing some private neurosis. Almost all imaginative people heard voices. Not just thoughts, but actual voices inside their heads. Different personae, each as clearly defined as voices on an old-time radio show. They came from the right side of the brain, the teacher explained, the side which is most commonly associated with visions and telepathy, and that striking human ability to create images by drawing comparisons and making metaphors. There are no such things as flying saucers. Oh, yeah? Who says so? The Air Force, for one. They closed the books on flying saucers 20 years ago. They were able to explain all but 3% of all verified sightings, and they have said those last three were almost certainly caused by ephemeral atmospheric conditions, stuff like sun dogs, clear air turbulence, pockets of clear air electricity. Hell, the Lubbock lights were front-page news, and all they turned out to be was, well, there were these traveling packs of moths, see? And the Lubbock streetlights hit their wings and reflected big light-colored moving shapes onto the low cloud masses that a stagnant weather pattern kept over the town for a week. Most of the country spent that week thinking someone dressed like Michael Rennie in The Day the Earth Stood Still was going to come, walking up Lubbock's main drag with his pet robot Gort, clanking along beside him, demanding to be taken to our leader. And they were moths. Do you like it? Don't you have to like it? This voice was so clear it was amusing. It was that of Dr. Klingerman, who had taught the seminar. It lectured her with good old Klingy's unfailing, if rather shrill, enthusiasm. Anderson smiled and lit a cigarette. Smoking a little too much tonight, but the damn things were going stale anyway. In 1947, an Air Force captain named Mantell flew too high while he was chasing a flying saucer, what he thought was a flying saucer. He blacked out. His plane crashed. Mantell was killed. He died chasing a reflection of Venus on a high scud of clouds, a sun dog, in other words. So there are reflections of moths, reflections of Venus, and probably reflections in a golden eye as well, Bobby, but there are no flying saucers. Then what is that in the ground? The voice of the lecturer fell still. It didn't know. So, in its place came Anne's voice, telling her for the third time that she was getting funny in the head, getting weird like Uncle Frank, saying they'd be measuring her for one of those canvas coats you wear backwards soon. They'd cart her up to the asylum in Bangor, or the one in Juniper Hill, and she could rave about flying saucers in the woods while she wove baskets. It was Sissy's voice, all right. She could call her on the phone right now, tell her what had happened, and get that scripture by chapter and by verse. She knew it. But was it right? No, it wasn't. Anne would equate her sister's mostly solitary life with madness, no matter what Bobby did or said. And yes, the idea that the thing in the earth was some sort of spaceship certainly was mad. But was playing with the possibility, at least until it was disproven, mad? Anne would think so, but Anderson did not. Nothing wrong with keeping an open mind. Yet the speed with which the possibility had occurred to her. She got up and went inside. Last time she had fooled with that thing in the woods, she had slept for 12 hours. She wondered if she could expect a similar sleep marathon this time. She felt almost tired enough to sleep 12 hours, God knew. Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. But she wouldn't, she thought, pulling off her Opus for President t-shirt. Not just yet. The trouble with living alone, she had discovered, and the reason why most people she knew didn't like to be alone, even for a little while, was that the longer you lived alone, the louder those voices on the right side of your brain got. As the yardsticks of rationality began to shrink in the silence, those voices did not just request attention, they demanded it. It was easy to become frightened of them, to think they meant madness after all. Anne would sure think they did, Bobby thought, climbing into bed. The lamp cast a clean and comforting circle of light on the counterpane, but she left the thesis she'd been reading on the floor. She kept expecting the cramps that usually accompanied her occasional early and heavy menstrual flow, but so far they hadn't come. Not that she was anxious for them to put in an appearance, you should understand. She crossed her hands behind her head and looked at the ceiling. "No, you're not crazy at all, Bobby," she thought. "You think guard's getting wiggy, but you're perfectly all right. Isn't that also a sign that you're wobbling? There's even a name for it. Denial and substitution. I'm all right. It's the world that's crazy." All true. But she still felt firmly in control of herself, and sure of one thing. She was saner in Haven than she had been in Cleves Mills, and much saner than she had been in Utica. A few more years in Utica, a few more years around Sissy, and she would have been as mad as a hatter. Anderson believed Anne actually saw driving her close relatives crazy as part of her job? No, nothing so mundane, as part of her sacred mission in life. She knew what was really troubling her, and it wasn't the speed with which the possibility had occurred. It was the feeling of certainty. She would keep an open mind, but the struggle would be to keep it open in favor of what Anne would call sanity, because she knew what she had found. And it filled her with fear and awe and a restless, moving excitement. "See, Anne, old Bobby didn't move up to Sticksville and go crazy. Old Bobby moved up here and went sane. Insanity is limiting possibilities, Anne. Can you dig it? Insanity is refusing to go down certain paths of speculation, even though the logic is there. Like a token for the turnstile. See what I mean? No? Of course you don't. You don't, and you never did. Then go away, Anne. Stay in Utica and grind your teeth in your sleep until there's nothing left of them. Make whoever is mad enough to stay within range of your voice crazy be my guest, but stay out of my head." The thing in the earth was a ship from space. There. It was out. No more bullshit. Never mind Anne. Never mind the Lubbock lights or how the Air Force had closed its file on flying saucers. Never mind the chariots of the gods or the Bermuda Triangle or how Elijah was drawn up to heaven in a wheel of fire. Never mind any of it. Her heart knew what her heart knew. It was a ship, and it had either landed or crash-landed a long time ago, maybe millions of years ago. God! She lay in bed, hands behind her head. She was calm enough, but her heart was beating fast, fast, fast. Then another voice, and this was the voice of her dead grandfather repeating something Anne's voice had said earlier. "Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous." That momentary vibration, her first premonition, suffocating and positive, that she had found the edge of some weird steel coffin. Peter's reaction. Starting her period early, only spotting here at the farm, but bleeding like a stuck pig when she was close to it. Losing track of time. Sleeping the clock all the way around. And don't forget old Chuck the woodchuck. Chuck had smelled gassy and decomposed, but there were no flies. No flies on Chuck, you might say. None of that shit adds up to Shinola. I'll buy the possibility of a ship in the earth, because no matter how crazy it sounds at first, the logic's still there. But there's no logic to the rest of this stuff. They're loose beads rolling around on the table. Thread them onto a string, and maybe I'll buy it. I'll think about it anyway. Okay? Her grandfather's voice again. That slow, authoritative voice. The only one in the house that had even been able to strike Anne silent as a kid. "Those things all happened after you found it, Bobby. That's your string." "No. Not enough." Easy enough to talk back to her grandfather now. The man was 16 years in his grave. but it was her grandfather's voice that followed her down to sleep, nevertheless. "Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. And you know that, too." Chapter 3 Peter Sees the Light 1 She thought she had seen something different about Peter, but hadn't been able to tell exactly what it was. When Anderson woke up the next morning at a perfectly normal 9 o'clock, she saw it almost at once. She stood at the counter pouring gravy train into Peter's old red dish. As always, Peter came strolling in at the sound. The gravy train was fairly new. Up until this year, the deal had always been Gaines' meal in the morning, half a can of rival canned dog food at night, and everything Pete could catch in the woods in between. Then Peter had stopped eating the Gaines' meal, and it had taken Anderson almost a month to catch on. Peter wasn't bored. What remained of his teeth simply couldn't manage to crunch up the nuggets anymore. So now he got gravy train, the equivalent, she supposed, of an old man's poached egg for breakfast. She ran warm water over the gravy train nuggets, then stirred them with the old battered spoon she kept for the purpose. Soon the softening nuggets floated in a muddy liquid that actually did look like gravy. Either that, Anderson thought, or something out of a backed-up septic tank. "Here you go," she said, turning away from the sink. Peter was now in his accustomed spot on the linoleum, a polite distance away so Anderson wouldn't trip over him when she turned around, and thumping his tail. "Hope you enjoy it. Myself, I think I'd Ralph my git." That was where she stopped, bent over with Peter's red dish in her right hand, her hair falling over one eye. She brushed it away. "Pete?" she heard herself say. Peter looked at her quizzically for a moment and then padded forward to get his morning kip. A moment later he was slurping it up enthusiastically. Anderson straightened, looking at her dog, rather glad she could no longer see Peter's face. In her head, her grandfather's voice told her again to leave it alone. It was dangerous. And did she need any more string for her beads? There are about 1 million people in this country alone who would come running if they got wind of this kind of dangerous, Anderson thought. God knows how many in the rest of the world. And is that all it does? How is it on cancer, do you suppose? All the strength suddenly ran out of her legs. She felt her way backward until she touched one of the kitchen chairs. She sat down and watched Peter eat. The milky cataract, which had covered his left eye, was now half gone. 2. "I don't have the slightest idea," the vet said that afternoon. Anderson sat in the examining room's only chair, while Peter sat obediently on the examining table. Anderson found herself remembering how she had dreaded the possibility of having to bring Peter to the vet's this summer. Only now it didn't look as if Peter would have to be put down after all. "But it isn't just my imagination?" Anderson asked. And she supposed that what she really wanted was for Dr. Etheridge to either confirm or confute the Anne in her head. "It's what you deserve, living out there alone with your smelly dog." "Nope," Etheridge said. "Although I can understand why you feel flummoxed. I feel a little flummoxed myself." "His cataract is in active remission. You can get down, Peter." Peter climbed down from the table, going first to Etheridge's stool, and then to the floor, and then to Anderson. Anderson put her hand on Peter's head and looked closely at Etheridge, thinking, "Did you see that?" not quite wanting to say it out loud. For a moment Etheridge met her eyes, and then he looked away. "I saw it, yes, but I'm not going to admit that I saw it." Peter had gotten down carefully, in a descent that was miles from the devil-take-the-hindmost bounds of the puppy he had once been, but neither was it the trembling, tentative, wobbly descent Peter would have made even a week ago, cocking his head unnaturally to the right, so he could see where he was going, his balance so vague that your heart stopped until he was down with no bones broken. Peter came down with the conservative yet solid confidence of the elder statesman he had been 2 or 3 years ago. Some of it, Anderson supposed, was the fact that the vision in his left eye was returning. Etheridge had confirmed that with a few simple perception tests. But the eye wasn't all of it. The rest was overall improved body coordination. Simple as that. Crazy, but simple. and the shrinking cataract hadn't caused Pete's muzzle to return to salt and pepper from an almost solid white, had it? Anderson had noticed that in the pickup truck as they headed down to Augusta. She had almost driven off the road. How much of this was Etheridge seeing and not being prepared to admit he was seeing? Quite a bit, Anderson guessed. But part of it was just that Etheridge wasn't Doc Daggett. Daggett had seen Peter at least twice a year during the first 10 years of Peter's life. And then there were the things that came up, like the time Pete had mixed in with a porcupine, for instance, and Daggett had removed the quills, one by one, whistling the theme music from The Bridge on the River Kwai as he did so, soothing the trembling year-old dog with one big kindly hand. On another occasion, Peter had come limping home with a backside full of birdshot, a cruel present from a hunter, either too stupid to look before he shot, or perhaps sadistic enough to inflict misery on a dog because he couldn't find a partridge or pheasant to inflict it on. Dr. Daggett would have seen all the changes in Peter, and would not have been able to deny them, even if he had wished to. Dr. Daggett would have taken off his pink-rimmed glasses, polished them on his white coat, and said something like, "We have to find out where he's been, and what he's gotten into, Roberta. This is serious. Dogs don't just get younger. And that is what Peter appears to be doing." That would have forced Anderson to reply, "I know where he's been, and I've got a pretty good idea of what did it." And that would have taken a lot of the pressure off, wouldn't it? But old Doc Daggett had sold the practice to Etheridge, who seemed nice enough but who was still something of a stranger, and retired to Florida. Etheridge had seen Peter more often than Daggett had done, 4 times in the last year, as it happened, because as Peter grew older he had grown steadily more infirm, but he still hadn't seen him as often as his predecessor, and, she suspected, he didn't have his predecessor's clear-eyed perceptions, or his guts. From the ward behind them, a German shepherd suddenly exploded a string of heavy barks that sounded like a string of canine curses. Other dogs picked it up. Peter's ears cocked forward, and he began to tremble under Anderson's hand. The Benjamin Button routine apparently hadn't done a thing for the beagle's equanimity, Anderson thought. Once through his puppyhood storms, Peter had been so laid back he was damn near paralytic. This high-strung trembling was brand new. Etheridge was listening to the dogs with a slight frown. Now almost all of them were barking. "Thanks for seeing us on such short notice," Anderson said. She had to raise her voice to be heard. A dog in the waiting room also started to bark, the quick, nervous yappings of a very small animal, a palm or a poodle, most likely. It was very... Her voice broke momentarily. She felt a vibration under her fingertips, and her first thought, the ship, was of the thing in the woods. But she knew what this vibration was. Although she had felt it very, very seldom, there was no mystery about it. This vibration was coming from Peter. Peter was growling, very low and deep in his throat. "Kind of you, but I think we ought to split. Sounds like you've got a mutiny on your hands." She meant it as a joke, but it no longer sounded like a joke. Suddenly the entire small complex, the cinderblock square that was Etheridge's waiting room and treatment room, plus the attached cinderblock rectangle that was his ward and operating theater, was in an uproar. All the dogs out back were barking. And in the waiting room the palm had been joined by a couple of other dogs, and a feminine wavering wail that was unmistakably feline. Mrs. Alden popped in, looking distressed. "Dr. Etheridge—" "All right," he said, sounding cross. "Excuse me, Miss Anderson." He left in a hurry, heading for the first ward. When he opened the door, the noise of the dogs seemed to double. "They're going bug shit," Anderson thought. And that was all she had time to think, because Peter almost lunged out from under her hand. That idling growl deep in his throat suddenly roughened into a snarl. Etheridge, already hurrying down the ward's central corridor, dogs barking all around him and the door swinging slowly shut on its pneumatic elbow behind him, didn't hear, but Anderson did, and if she hadn't been lucky in her grab for Peter's collar, the beagle would have been across the room like a shot and into the ward after the doctor. The trembling and the deep growl. Those hadn't been fear, she realized. They had been rage. It was inexplicable, completely unlike Peter, but that's what it had been. Peter's snarl turned into a strangled sound, "Yawk," as Anderson pulled him back by the collar. He turned his head, and in Peter's rolling red-rimmed right eye, Anderson saw what she would later characterize only as fury at being turned from the course he wanted to follow. She could acknowledge the possibility that there was a flying saucer 300 yards around its outer rim buried on her property, the possibility that some emanation or vibration from this ship had killed a woodchuck that had the bad luck to get a little too close, killed it so completely and unpleasantly that even the flies seemingly wanted no part of it. She could deal with an anomalous menstrual period, a canine cataract in her emission, even with the seeming certainty that her dog was somehow growing younger. All this, yes. But the idea that she had seen an insane hate for her, for Bobby Anderson, in her good old dog Peter's eyes. No. 3. That moment was thankfully brief. The door to the ward shut, muffling the cacophony. Some of the tenseness seemed to go out of Peter. He was still trembling, but at least he sat down again. "Come on, Pete, we're getting out of here," Anderson said. She was badly shaken, much more so than she would later admit to Jim Gardiner. For to admit that would have perhaps led back to that furious leer of rage she had seen in Peter's good eye. She fumbled for the unfamiliar leash, which she had taken off Peter as soon as they got into the examination room. That dogs should be leashed when owners brought them in for examination was a requirement Anderson had always found annoying, until now, almost dropping it. At last she managed to attach it to Peter's collar. She led Peter to the door of the waiting room and pushed it open with her foot. The noise was worse than ever. The yapper was indeed a Pomeranian, the property of a fat woman wearing bright yellow slacks and a yellow top. Fatso was trying to hold the palm, telling it to be a good boy, Eric, be a good boy for Mommy. Very little save the dog's bright and somehow ratty eyes were visible between Mommy's large and flabby arms. "Miss Anderson," Mrs. Alden began. She looked bewildered and a little frightened, a woman trying to conduct business as usual in a place that had suddenly become a madhouse. Anderson understood how she felt. The palm spotted Peter. Anderson would later swear that was what set it off, and seemed to go crazy. It certainly had no problem choosing a target. It sank its sharp teeth into one of Mommy's arms.
"Cocksucker!"
Mommy screamed, and dropped the palm on the floor. Blood began to run down her arm. At the same time, Peter lunged forward, barking and snarling, fetching up at the end of the short leash hard enough to jerk Anderson forward. Her right arm flagged out straight. With the clear eye of her rider's mind, Anderson saw exactly what was going to happen next. Peter the Beagle and Eric the Palm were going to meet in the middle of the room like David and Goliath, but the Palm had no brains, let alone a sling. Peter would tear its head off with one large chomp. This was averted by a girl of perhaps 11, who was sitting to Mommy's left. The girl had a porticary on her lap. Inside was a large black snake, its scales glowing with luxuriant good health. The little girl shot out one jeans-clad leg with the unearthly reflexes of the very young, and stomped on the trailing end of Eric's leash. Eric did one complete snap roll. The little girl reeled the palm in. She was by far the calmest person in the waiting room.
"What if that little fucker gave me the rabies?"
Mommy was screaming as she advanced across the room toward Mrs. Alden.
Blood twinkled between the fingers clapped to her arm.
Peter's head turned toward her as she passed, and Anderson pulled him back, heading toward the door. "Fuck the little sign in Mrs. Alden's cubbyhole," reading, "It is customary to pay cash for professional services unless other arrangements have been made in advance." She wanted to get out of here and drive the speed limit all the way home and have a drink. Cuddy, a double. On second thought, make that a triple. From her left came a long, low, virulent hissing sound. Anderson turned in that direction and saw a cat that might have stepped out of a Halloween decoration. Black, except for a single dab of white at the end of its tail. It had backed up as far as its carrying cage would allow. Its back was humped up. Its fur stood straight up in hackles. Its green eyes, fixed unwaveringly on Peter, glowed fantastically. Its pink mouth was jointed wide, ringed with teeth.
"Get your dog out, lady,"
the woman with the cat said in a voice cold as a cocking trigger.
"Blackie don't like him."
Anderson wanted to tell her she didn't care if Blackie farted or blew a tin whistle, but she would not think of this obscure but somehow exquisitely apt expression until later. She rarely did in hot situations. Her characters always knew exactly the right things to say, and she rarely had to deliberate over them. They came easily and naturally. This was almost never the case in real life. "Hold your water," was the best she could do, and she spoke it in such a craven mutter that she doubted if Blackie's owner had the slightest idea what she had said, or maybe even that she had said anything at all. She really was pulling Peter now, using the leash to yank the dog along in a way she hated to see a dog pulled whenever she observed it being done on the street. Peter was making coughing noises in his throat, and his tongue was a saliva-dripping runner hanging askew from one side of his mouth. He stared at a boxer whose right foreleg was in a cast. A big man in a blue mechanic's coverall was holding the boxer's rope leash with both hands. Had, in fact, taken a double twist of the hay rope around one big grease-stained fist, and was still having trouble holding his dog, which could have killed Peter as quickly and efficiently as Peter himself could have the Pomeranian. The boxer was pulling mightily in spite of its broken leg, and Anderson had more faith in the mechanic's grip than she did the hay rope leash, which appeared to be fraying. It seemed to Anderson that she fumbled for the knob of the outer door with her free hand for 100 years. It was like having a nightmare, where your hands are full and your pants start slowly and inexorably to slip down. Peter did this, somehow. She turned the knob, then took one final hasty glance around the waiting room. It had become an absurd little no-man's land. Mommy was demanding first aid of Mrs. Alden, and apparently really did need some. Blood was now coursing down her arm in freshets, spotting her yellow slacks and white institutional shoes. Blackie the cat was still hissing. Even Dr. Etheridge's gerbils were going mad in the complicated maze of plastic tubes and towers on the far shelf that made up their home. Eric, the crazed Pomeranian, stood at the end of his leash, barking at Peter in a strangled voice. Peter was snarling back. Anderson's eye fell on the little girl's black snake, and saw that it had reared up like a cobra inside its porticary and was also looking at Peter, its fangless mouth yawning, its narrow pink tongue shuttling at the air in stiff little jabs.
"Black snakes don't do that. I never saw a black snake do that in my life."
Now, in something very close to real horror, Anderson fled, dragging Peter after her. 4. Pete began to calm down almost as soon as the door sighed shut behind them. He stopped coughing and dragging on the leash and began to walk at Anderson's side, glancing at her occasionally in that way that said, "I don't like this leash, and I'm never going to like it, but okay, okay, if it's what you want." By the time they were both in the cab of the pickup, Peter was entirely his old self again. Anderson was not. Her hands were shaking so badly that she had to try 3 times before she could get the ignition key into its slot. Then she popped the clutch and stalled the engine. The Chevy pickup gave a mighty jerk, and Peter tumbled off the seat onto the floor. He gave Anderson a reproachful beagle look. Although all dogs are capable of reproachful looks, only beagles seem to have mastered that long-suffering stare.
"Where did you say you got your license, Bobby?"
that expression seemed to ask.
"Sears and Roebuck?"
Then he climbed up on the seat again. Anderson was already finding it hard to believe that only 5 minutes ago Peter had been growling and snarling, a bad-tempered dog she had never encountered before, apparently ready to bite anything that moved. And that expression, that... But her mind snapped shut on that before it could go any further. She got the engine going again and then headed out of the parking lot. As she passed the side of the building, Augusta Veterinary Clinic, the neat sign read, she rolled her window down. A few barks and yaps, nothing out of the ordinary. It had stopped. And that wasn't all that had stopped, she thought. Although she couldn't be completely sure, she thought her period was over too. If so, good riddance to bad rubbish, to coin a phrase. 5. Bobby didn't want to wait, or couldn't, to get back before having the drink she had promised herself. Just outside the Augusta city limits was a roadhouse that went by the charming name of the Big Lost Weekend Bar and Grill. Whopper's spare ribs, our specialty. The Nashville kitty cats, this fry and sad. Anderson pulled in between an old station wagon and a John Deere tractor with a dirty harrow on the back with its blades kicked up. Further down was a big old Buick with a horse trailer behind. Anderson had kept away from that on purpose. "Stay," Anderson said, and Peter, now curled up on the seat, gave her a look as if to say, "Why would I want to go anywhere with you, so you can choke me some more with that stupid leash?" The big lost weekend was dark and nearly deserted on a Wednesday afternoon, its dance floor a cavern which glimmered faintly. The place reeked of sour beer. The bartender, cum counterman, strolled down and said, "Howdy, pretty lady. The chili's on special. Also—" "I'd like a cutty, sir," Anderson said. "Double. Water back." "You always drink like a man?" "Usually from a glass," Anderson said. A quip which made no sense at all, but she felt very tired, and harrowed to the bone. She went into the ladies to change her pad, and did slip one of the minis from her purse into the crotch of her panties as a precaution. But precaution was all it was, and that was a relief. It seemed that the Cardinal had flown off for another month. She returned to her stool in a better humor than she had left it, and felt better still when she had gotten half the drink inside her. "Say, I sure didn't mean to offend you," the bartender said. "Gets lonely in here afternoons. When a stranger comes in, my lip gets runny." "My fault," Anderson said. "I haven't been having the best day of my life." She finished the drink and sighed. "You want another one, miss?"
"I think I like Purdy Lady better," Anderson thought, and shook her head.
"I'll take a glass of milk, though. Otherwise I'll have acid indigestion all afternoon." The bartender brought her the milk. Anderson sipped it and thought about what had happened at the vet's. The answer was quick and simple. She didn't know.
"But I'll tell you what happened when you brought him in," she thought. "Not a thing."
Her mind seized on this. The waiting room had been almost as crowded when she brought Peter in as it had been when she dragged him back out, only there had been no bedlam seen the first time. The place had not been quiet. Animals of different types and species, many of them ancient and instinctive antagonists, do not make for a library atmosphere when brought together, but it had been normal. Now, with the booze working in her, she recalled the man in the mechanic's coverall leading the boxer in. The boxer had looked at Peter. Peter had looked mildly back. No big deal. "So?"
"So drink your milk and get on home and forget it."
"Okay. And what about that thing in the woods? Do I forget that, too?" Instead of an answer, her grandfather's voice came. "By the way, Bobby, what's that thing doing to you?" "Have you thought about that?"
She hadn't.
Now that she had, she was tempted to order another drink. Except another, even a single, would make her drunk. And did she really want to be sitting in this huge barn in the early afternoon getting drunk alone, waiting for the inevitable someone, maybe the bartender himself, to cruise up and ask what a pretty place like this was doing around a girl like her? She left a five on the counter, and the bartender saluted her. On her way out, she saw a payphone. The phone book was dirty and dog-eared and smelled of used bourbon, but at least it was still there. Anderson deposited 20 cents, crooked the handset between shoulder and ear while she hunted through the V's and the yellow pages, then called Etheridge's clinic. Mrs. Alden sounded quite composed. In the background she could hear one dog barking. One. "I didn't want you to think I stiffed you," she said, "and I'll mail your leash back tomorrow."
"Not at all, Miss Anderson," she said. "After all the years you've done business with us, you're the last person we'd worry about when it comes to deadbeats. As for leashes, we've got a closet full."
Things seemed a little crazy there for a while.
Boy, were they ever! We had to call medics for Mrs. Perkins. I didn't think it was bad. Chillum needed stitches, of course, but lots of people who need stitches get to the doctor under their own power.
She lowered her voice a little, offering Anderson a confidence that she probably wouldn't have offered a man.
"Thank God it was her own dog that bit her. She's the sort of woman who starts shouting lawsuit at the drop of a hat."
"Any idea what might have caused it?"
"No. Neither does Dr. Etheridge. The heat after the rain, maybe. Dr. Etheridge said he heard of something like it once at a convention. A vet from California said all the animals in her clinic had what she called a savage spell just before the last big quake out there.
Is that so?
There was an earthquake in Maine last year, Mrs. Alden said.
Hope there won't be another one. That nuclear plant at Wiscasset is too close for comfort. Just ask Guard, Bobby thought.
She said thanks again and hung up. Anderson went back to the truck. Peter was sleeping. He opened his eyes when Anderson got in, then closed them again. His muzzle lay on his paws. The gray on that muzzle was fading away. No question about it. No question at all.
And by the way, Bobby,
what's that thing doing to you?
Shut up, Granddad. She drove home, and after fortifying herself with a second scotch, a weak one, she went into the bathroom and stood close to the mirror, first examining her face and then running her fingers through her hair, lifting it and then letting it drop. The gray was still there, all of it that had so far come in, as far as she could tell. She never would have thought she would be glad to see gray hair, but she was, sort of. 6. By early evening, dark clouds had begun to build up in the west, and by dark it had commenced thundering. The rains were going to return, it seemed, at least for a one-night stand. Anderson knew she wouldn't get Peter outside that night to do more than the most pressing doggy business. Since his puppyhood, the beagle had been utterly terrified of thunderstorms. Anderson sat in her rocker by the window, and if someone had been there, she supposed it would have looked like she was reading. But what she was really doing was grinding. Grinding grimly away at the thesis, Range War and Civil War. It was as dry as dust, but she thought it was going to be extremely useful when she finally got around to the new one, which should be fairly soon now. Each time the thunder rolled, Peter edged a little closer to the rocker and Anderson, seeming almost to grin shamefacedly.
"Yeah, it's not going to hurt me, I know, but I'll just get a little closer to you, okay? And if there comes a real blast, I'll just about crowd you out of that fucking rocker. What do you say? You don't mind, do you, Bobby?"
The storm held off until 9 o'clock, and by then Anderson was pretty sure they were going to have a good one, what the Havenites call a real geezer. She went into the kitchen, rummaged in the walk-in closet that served as her pantry, and found her Coleman gas lantern on a high shelf. Peter followed directly behind her, tail between his legs, shame-faced grin on his face. Anderson almost fell over him coming out of the closet with the lantern.
"Do you mind, Peter?"
Peter gave a little ground, and then crowded up to Anderson's ankles again when thunder cannonaded hard enough to rattle the windows. As Anderson got back to her chair, lightning sheeted blue-white, and the phone tinged. The wind began to rise, making the trees rustle and sigh. Peter sat hard by the rocker, looking up at Anderson, pleadingly.
"Okay," she said with a sigh. "Come on up, jerk."
Peter didn't have to be asked twice. He sprang onto Anderson's lap, getting her crotch a pretty good one, with one forepaw. He always seemed to wang her there or on one boob. He didn't aim. It was just one of those mysterious things, like the way elevators invariably stopped at every floor when you were in a hurry. If there was a defense, Bobby Anderson had yet to find it. Thunder tore across the sky. Peter crowded against her. His smell, eau de beagle, filled Anderson's nose.
"Why don't you just jump down my throat and have done with it, Pete?"
Peter grinned his shame-faced grin as if to say,
I know it, don't rub it in."
The wind rose. The lights began to flicker, a sure sign that Roberta Anderson and Central Maine Power were about to bid each other a fond adieu, at least until 3 or 4 in the morning. Anderson laid the thesis aside and put her arm around her dog. She didn't really mind the occasional summer storm, or the winter blizzards, for that matter. She liked their big power. She liked the sight and sound of that power working on the land in its crude and blindly positive way. She sensed insensate compassion in the workings of such storms. She could feel this one working inside her. The hair on her arms and the nape of her neck stirred, and a particularly close shot of lightning
left her feeling almost galvanized with energy. She remembered an odd conversation she'd once had with Jim Gardner. Gard had a steel plate in his skull, a souvenir of a skiing accident that had almost killed him at the age of 17. Gardner had told her that once, while changing a light bulb, he had gotten a hell of a shock by inadvertently sticking his forefinger into the socket. This was hardly uncommon. The peculiar part was that for the next week he had heard music and announcers and newscasts in his head. He told Anderson he had really believed for a while he was going crazy. On the fourth day of this, Gard had even identified the call letters of the station he was receiving, WZON, one of Bangor's 3 a.m. radio stations. He had written down the names of three songs in a row, and then called the station to see if they had indeed played those songs, plus ads for Singh's Polynesian Restaurant, Village Subaru, and the Bird Museum in Bar Harbor. They had. On the fifth day, he said, the signal started to fade, and 2 days later it was gone entirely. "It was that damn skull plate," he had told her, rapping his fist gently on the scar by his left temple. "No doubt about it. I'm sure thousands would laugh, but in my own mind I'm completely sure." If someone else had told her the story, Anderson would have believed she was having her leg pulled. But Jim hadn't been kidding. You looked in his eyes and you knew he wasn't. Big storms had big power. Lightning flared in a blue sheet, giving Anderson a shuddered click of what she had come to think of, as her neighbors did, as her dooryard. She saw the truck, with the first drops of rain on its windshield, the short dirt driveway, the mailbox with its flag down and tucked securely against its aluminum side, the writhing trees. Thunder exploded a bare moment later, and Peter jumped against her, whining. The lights went out. They didn't bother dimming or flickering or messing around. They went out all at once, completely. They went out with authority. Anderson reached for the lantern, and then her hand stopped. There was a green spot on the far wall, just to the right of Uncle Frank's Welsh dresser. It bobbed up 2 inches, moved left, then right. It disappeared for a moment, then came back. Anderson's dream recurred with all the eerie power of déjà vu. She thought again of the lantern in Poe's story, but mixed in this time was another memory. The War of the Worlds, the Martian heat ray raining green death on Hammersmith. She turned toward Peter, hearing the tendons in her neck creak like dirty door hinges, knowing what she was going to see. The light was coming from Peter's eye. His left eye. It glared with the witchy green light of St. Elmo's fire drifting over a swamp after a still, muggy day. No, not the eye. It was the cataract that was glowing, at least what remained of the cataract. It had gone back noticeably even from that morning at the vet's office. That side of Peter's face was lit with a lurid green light, making him look like a comic book monstrosity. Her first impulse was to get away from Peter, dive out of the chair and simply run. But this was Peter, after all, and Peter was scared to death already. If she deserted him, Peter would be terrified. Thunder cracked in the black. This time both of them jumped. Then the rain came in a great sighing, sheet-like rush. Anderson looked back at the wall across the room again, at the green splotch bobbing and weaving there. She was reminded of times she had lain in bed as a child, using the watchband of her Timex to play a similar spot off the wall by moving her wrist. "And by the way, what's it doing to you, Bobby?" Green sunken fire in Peter's eye, taking away the cataract, eating it. She looked again, and had to restrain herself from jerking back when Peter licked her hand. That night, Bobby Anderson slept hardly at all. Chapter 4 The Dig Continued 1 When Anderson finally woke up, it was almost 10 a.m., and most of the lights in the place were on. Central Maine Power had gotten its shit together again, it seemed. She walked around the place in her socks, turning off lights, and then looked out the front window. Peter was on the porch. Anderson let him in and looked closely at his eye. She could remember her terror of the night before,
But in this morning's bright summer daylight, terror had been supplanted by fascination. Anyone would have been scared, she thought, seeing something like that in the dark, with the power out and a thunderstorm stomping the earth and the sky outside. Why in hell didn't Etheridge see this? But that was easy. The dials of radium watches glow in the day as well as in the dark. You just can't see the glow in bright light. She was a little surprised she had missed the green glow in Peter's eye on previous nights, but hardly flabbergasted. After all, it had taken her a couple of days to even realize the cataract was shrinking. And yet, Etheridge had been close, hadn't he? Etheridge had been right in there with the old ophthalmoscope, looking into Peter's eye. He had agreed with Anderson that the cataract was shrinking, but hadn't mentioned any glow, green or otherwise. Maybe he saw it and decided to unsee it, the way he saw Peter looking younger and decided he didn't see that, because he didn't want to see that. There was a part of her that didn't like the new vet a whole hell of a lot. She supposed it was because she had liked old Doc Daggett so much and had made that foolish but apparently unavoidable assumption that Daggett would be around as long as she and Peter were. But it was a silly reason to feel hostility toward the old man's replacement, and even if Etheridge had failed or refused to see Peter's apparent age regression, that didn't change the fact that he seemed a perfectly competent vet. A cataract that glowed green. She didn't think he would have ignored something like that. Which led her to the conclusion that the green glow hadn't been there for Etheridge to see. At least not right away. There hadn't been any big hoorah right away either, had there? Not when they came in, not during the exam. Only when they were getting ready to go out. Had Peter's eye started to glow then? Anderson poured gravy train into Peter's dish and stood with her left hand under the tap, waiting for the water to come in warm so she could wet it down. The wait kept getting longer and longer. Her water heater was slow, balky, sadly out of date. Anderson had been meaning to have it replaced, would certainly have to do so before cold weather. But the only plumber either in Haven or the rural towns to Haven's immediate north and south was a rather unpleasant fellow named Delbert Chiles, who always looked at her as if he knew exactly what she would look like with her clothes off. "Not much," his eyes said, "but I guess it'd do in a pinch." And always wanted to know if Anderson was writing any new books lately. Chiles liked to tell her that he could have been a damn good writer himself, but he had too much energy, and not enough glue on the seat of my pants, get me? The last time she'd been forced to call him had been when the pipes burst in the -20s cold snap winter before last. After he set things to rights, he had asked her if she would like to go steppin' sometime. Anderson declined politely, and Chiles tipped her a wink that aspired to worldly wisdom, and made it, almost, to informed vacuity. "You don't know what you're missing, sweetie," he said. "I'm pretty sure I do, which is why I said no," had come to her lips. But she said nothing. As little as she liked him, she had known she might need Chiles again sometime. Why was it the really good zingers only came immediately to mind in real life when you didn't dare use them? "You could do something about that hot water heater, Bobby," a voice in her mind spoke up, one that she couldn't identify. A stranger's voice in her head? Oh, golly, should she call the cops? "But you could," the voice insisted. "All you'd need to do would be..." But then the water started to come in warm, tepid anyway, and she forgot about the water heater. She stirred the gravy train, then set it down and watched Peter eat. He was showing a much better appetite these days. "Ought to check his teeth," she thought. "Maybe you can go back to Gaines' meal. A penny saved is a penny earned, and the American reading public is not exactly beating a path to your door, babe, and..." And exactly when had the uproar in the clinic started? Anderson thought about this carefully. She couldn't be completely sure, but the more she thought about it, the more it seemed that it might have been, not for sure, but might have been, right after Dr. Etheridge finished examining Peter's cataract and put down the ophthalmoscope. "Attend, Watson," the voice of Sherlock Holmes suddenly spoke up in the quick, almost urgent speech rhythms of Basil Rathbone.
The eye glows. No, not the eye. The cataract glows. But Anderson does not observe it, although she should. Etheridge does not observe it, and he definitely should. May we say that the animals at the veterinary clinic do not become upset until Peter's cataract begins to glow, until, we might further theorize, the healing process has resumed? Possibly. That the glow is seen only when being seen is safe? Ah, Watson, that is an assumption as frightening as it is unwarranted, because that would indicate some sort of intelligence. Anderson didn't like where this was leading, and tried to choke it off with the old reliable advice, let it go. This time it worked. For a while. 2. Anderson wanted to go out and dig some more. Her forebrain didn't like that idea at all. Her forebrain thought that idea sucked. Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. Right. And, by the way, what's it doing to you? Nothing she could see. But you couldn't see what cigarette smoke did to your lungs, either. That's why people went on smoking. It could be that her liver was rotting, that the chambers of her heart were silting up with cholesterol, or that she had rendered herself barren. For all she knew, her bone marrow might be producing outlaw white cells like mad right this minute. Why settle for an early period when you could have something really interesting like leukemia, Bobby? But she wanted to dig it up just the same. This urge, simple and elemental, had nothing to do with her forebrain. It came baking up from someplace deeper inside. It had all the earmarks of some physical craving. For salt, for some coke or heroin or cigarettes or coffee. Her forebrain supplied logic. This other part supplied an almost incoherent imperative. Dig on it, Bobby. It's okay. Dig on it. Dig on it. Shit, why not dig on it a while more? You know you want to know what it is, so dig on it till you see what it is. Dig, dig, dig. She was able to turn the voice off by conscious effort, and would then realize 15 minutes later she had been listening to it again, as if to a Delphic oracle. You've got to tell somebody what you found. Who? The police? Uh-uh. No way. Or who? She was in her garden, madly weeding, a junkie in withdrawal. Or anyone in authority, her mind finished. Her right brain supplied Anne's sarcastic laughter, as she had known it would. But the laughter didn't have as much force as she had feared. Like a good many of her generation, Anderson didn't put a great deal of stock in let the authorities handle it. Her distrust in the way the authorities handled things had begun at the age of 13 in Utica. She had been sitting on the sofa in their living room with Anne on one side and her mother on the other. She had been eating a hamburger and watching the Dallas police escort Lee Harvey Oswald across an underground parking garage. There were lots of Dallas police. So many, in fact, that the TV announcer was telling the country that someone had shot Oswald before all those police, all those people in authority, seemed to have the slightest inkling something had gone wrong, let alone what it was. So far as she could tell, the Dallas police had done such a good job protecting John F. Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald that they had been put in charge of the summer race riots 2 years later, and then the war in Vietnam. Other assignments followed, handling the oil embargo 10 years after the Kennedy assassination, the negotiations to secure the release of the American hostages at the embassy in Tehran, and when it became clear that the ragheads were not going to listen to the voice of reason and authority, Jimmy Carter had sent the Dallas police in to rescue those poor fellers. After all, authorities who had handled that Kent State business with such cool-headed aplomb could surely be counted upon to perform the sort of job those Mission Impossible guys did every week. Well, the old Dallas police had had a spot of tough luck on that one, but by and large they had the situation under control. All you had to do was look at how damned orderly the world situation had become in the years since a man in a strappy T-shirt with Vitalis on his thinning hair and fried chicken grease under his fingernails had blown out a president's brains as he sat in the back seat of a Lincoln rolling down the street of a Texas cow town. I'll tell Jim Gardner. When he gets back.
Guard'll know what to do, how to handle it. He'll have some ideas, anyway.
Anne's voice. You're going to ask a certified loony for advice. Great.
He's not a loony. Just a little bit weird.
Yeah. Arrested at the last Seabrook demonstration with a loaded .45 in his backpack. That's weird, all right.
Anne, shut up. She weeded. All that morning in the hot sun she weeded. The back of her T-shirt wet with sweat. Last year's scarecrow wearing the hat she usually put on to keep the sun off. After lunch, she lay down to take a nap and couldn't sleep. Everything kept going through her mind, and that stranger's voice never shut up. Dig on it, Bobby. It's okay. Dig on it. Until, at last, she did get up, grabbed the crowbar, spade, and shovel, and set out for the woods. At the far end of her field she paused, forehead grooved in thought, and came back for her pickaxe. Peter was on the porch. He looked up briefly, but made no move to come with Anderson. Anderson was not really surprised. 3. So, about 20 minutes later, she stood above it, looking down the forested slope to the trench she had begun in the ground, freeing what she now believed was a very tiny section of an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Its gray hull was as solid as a wrench or a screwdriver, denying dreams and vapors and supposings. It was there. The dirt she had thrown to either side, moist and black and forest secret, was now a dark brown, still damp from last night's rain. Going down the slope, her foot crunched on something that sounded like newspaper. It wasn't newspaper. It was a dead sparrow. 20 feet further down was a dead crow, feet pointed comically skyward like a dead bird in a cartoon. Anderson paused, looked around, and saw the bodies of 3 other birds, another crow, a blue jay, and a scarlet tanager. No marks, just dead, and no flies around any of them. She reached the trench and dropped her tools on the bank. The trench was muddy. She stepped in, nevertheless, her work shoes squashing in the mud. She bent down and could see smooth gray metal going into the earth, a puddle standing on one side. What are you? She put her hand on it. That vibration sank into her skin and seemed for a moment to go all through her. Then it stopped. Anderson turned and put her hand on her shovel, feeling its smooth wood, slightly warmed by the sun. She was vaguely aware that she could hear no forest noises. None at all. No birds singing. No animals crashing through the undergrowth and away from the smell of a human being. She was more sharply aware of the smells, peaty earth, pine needles, bark, and sap. A voice inside her, very deep inside, not coming from the right side of her brain, but perhaps from the very root of her mind, screamed in terror. Something's happening, Bobby. Something is happening right now. Get out of here. Dead Chuck, dead birds, Bobby, please, please, please. Her hand tightened on the shovel's handle, and she saw it again as she had sketched it, the gray leading edge of something titanic in the earth. Her period had started again. But that was all right. She had put a pad in the crotch of her panties even before she went out to weed the garden, a maxi. And there were half a dozen more in her pack, weren't there? Or was it more like a dozen? She didn't know, and it didn't matter. Not even discovering some part of her had known she would end up here, in spite of whatever foolish conceptions of free will the rest of her mind might possess, disturbed her. A shining sort of peace had filled her. Dead animals, periods that stopped and started again, arriving prepared even after you had assured yourself the decision had not yet been taken. These were small things, smaller than small, a whole lot of bullshit. She would just dig for a while, dig on this sucker, see if there was anything but smooth metal skin to see, because everything's fine, Bobby Anderson said in the unnatural stillness. And then she began to dig.
Chapter 5 Gardner Takes a Fall 1 While Bobby Anderson was tracing a titanic shape with a compass and thinking the unthinkable with a brain more numbed with exhaustion than she knew, Jim Gardner was doing the only work he could these days. This time he was doing it in Boston. The poetry reading on June 25th was at BU. That went all right. The 26th was an off day. It was also the day that Gardner stumbled. Only, stumble didn't really describe what happened, unfortunately. It was no minor matter like snagging your foot under a root while you were walking in the woods. It was a fall that he took. One long fucking fall. Like taking a no-expenses-paid bone-smasher of a tumble down a long flight of stairs. Stairs? Shit, he had almost fallen off the face of the earth. The fall started in his hotel room. It ended on the breakwater at Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire, 8 days later. Bobby wanted to dig. Guard woke up on the morning of the 26th wanting to drink. He knew there was no such thing as a partially arrested alcoholic. You were either drinking or you weren't. He wasn't drinking now, and that was good. But there had always been long periods when he didn't even think about booze. Months, sometimes. He would drop into a meeting once in a while. If 2 weeks went by in which Gard didn't attend an AA meeting, he felt uneasy, the way he felt if he spilled salt and didn't toss some over his shoulder, and stand up and say, "Hi, my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." But when the urge was absent, it didn't feel like the truth. During these periods, he wasn't actually dry. He could and did drink. Drink, that was, as opposed to boozing. A couple of cocktails around 5, if he was at a faculty function or a faculty dinner party. Just that and no more. Or he could call Bobby Anderson and ask if she'd like to come over and go out for a couple of cold ones, and it was fine. No sweat. Then there would come a morning like this, when he would wake up wanting all the booze in the world. This seemed to be an actual thirst, a physical thing. It made him think of those cartoons Virgil Parch used to do in the Saturday Evening Post, the ones where some funky old prospector is always crawling across the desert, his tongue hanging out, looking for a waterhole. All he could do when the urge came on him was fight it off, stand it off, try to earn a draw. Sometimes it was actually better to be in a place like Boston when this happened, because you could go to a meeting every night. Every 4 hours, if that was what it took. After 3 or 4 days, it would go away. Usually. He would, he thought, just wait it out. Sit in his room and watch movies on cable TV and charge them to room service. He had spent the 8 years since his divorce and severance from college teaching as a full-time poet, which meant he had come to live in an odd little sub-society where barter was usually more important than money. He had traded poems for food. On one occasion, a birthday sonnet for a farmer's wife in exchange for 3 shopping bags of new potatoes. "Goddamn thing better rhyme, too," the farmer had said, fixing a stony eye upon Gardner. "Real poems rhyme." Gardner, who could take a hint, especially when his stomach was concerned, composed a sonnet so filled with exuberant masculine rhymes that he burst into gales of laughter after scanning the 2nd draft. He called Bobby, read it to her, and they both howled. It was even better out loud. Out loud, it sounded like a love letter from Dr. Seuss. But he hadn't needed Bobby to point out to him that it was still an honest piece of work, jangly, but not condescending. On another occasion, a small press in West Minot had agreed to publish a book of his poems. This had been in early 1983, and was, in fact, the last book of poems Gardner had published, and offered 1/2 cord of wood as an advance. Gardner took it. "You should have held out for 3/4 of a cord," Bobby had told him that night, as they sat in front of her stove, feet up on the fender, smoking cigarettes as the wind shrieked fresh snow across the fields and into the trees. "Those are good poems. There's a lot of them, too." "I know," Gardner said, "but I was cold. 1/2 a quart'll get me through until spring." He dropped her a wink. "Besides, the guy's from Connecticut. I don't think he knew most of it was ash." She dropped her feet to the floor and stared at him. "You kidding?
Nope.
She began to giggle, and he kissed her soundly, and later took her to bed, and they slept together like spoons. He remembered waking up once, listening to the wind, thinking of all the dark and rushing cold outside and all the warmth of this bed, filled with their peaceful heat under two quilts, and wishing it could be like this forever. Only nothing ever was. He had been raised to believe God was love. But you had to wonder how loving a God could be when he made men and women smart enough to land on the moon, but stupid enough to have to learn there was no such thing as forever, over and over again. The next day, Bobby had again offered money, and Gardner again refused. He wasn't exactly rolling in dough, but he made out. And he couldn't help the little spark of anger he felt, in spite of her matter-of-fact tone. "Don't you know who's supposed to get the money after a night in bed?" he asked. She stuck out her chin. "You calling me a whore?" he smiled. "You need a pimp? There's money in it, I hear. You want breakfast, guard, or do you want to piss me off? How about both?" "No," she said, and he saw she was really mad. Christ, he was getting worse and worse at seeing things like that, and it used to be so easy. He hugged her. "I was only kidding. Couldn't she see that?" he thought. She always used to be able to tell when I was kidding. But, of course, she hadn't known he was kidding because he hadn't been. If he believed different, the only one getting kidded was himself. He had been trying to hurt her because she embarrassed him. And it wasn't her offer that had been stupid, it was his embarrassment. He had more or less chosen the life he was living, hadn't he? And he didn't want to hurt Bobby, didn't want to drive Bobby away. The bed part was fine, but the bed part wasn't the really important part. The really important part was that Bobby Anderson was a friend. And something scary seemed to be happening just lately. How fast he seemed to be running out of friends. That was pretty scary, all right. Running out of friends? Or running them out? Which is it, guard? At first, hugging her was like hugging an ironing board, and he was afraid she would try to pull away and he would make the mistake of trying to hold on. But she finally softened. "I want breakfast," he said. "And to say I'm sorry." "It's all right," she said, and turned away before he could see her face. But her voice held that dry briskness that meant she was either crying or near it. "I keep forgetting it's bad manners to offer money to Yankees." Well, he didn't know if it was bad manners or not, but he would not take money from Bobby. Never had, never would. The New England Poetry Caravan, however, was a different matter. "Grab that chicken, son," Ron Cummings, who needed money about as much as the Pope needed a new hat, would have said. "The bitch is too slow to run and too fat to pass up." The New England Poetry Caravan paid cash, coin of the realm for poetry, 200 up front and 200 at the end of the tour. The word made flesh, you might say, but hard cash, it was understood, was only part of the deal. The rest was the tab. While you were on tour, you took advantage of every opportunity. You got your meals from room service, your hair cut in the hotel barbershop, if there was one, brought your extra pair of shoes, if you had one, and put them out one night instead of your regulars so you could get the extras shined up. There were the in-room movies, movies you never got a chance to see in a theater because theaters persisted in wanting money for much the same thing poets, even the very good ones, were, for some reason, supposed to provide for free, or next to it. 3 bags of spuds equals 1 sonnet, for instance. There was a room charge for the movies, of course, but what of that? You didn't even have to put them on the tab. Some computer did it automatically. And all Gardner had to say on the subject was, "God bless and keep the tab, and bring those fuckers on." He watched everything, from Emmanuel in New York, finding the part where the girl flogs the guy's doggy under a table at Windows on the World, particularly artistic and uplifting. It certainly uplifted part of him, anyway. To Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, to Rainbow Bright and the Star Stealer. "And that's what I'm going to do now," he thought, rubbing his throat and thinking about the taste of good aged whiskey. "Exactly what I'm going to do. Just sit here and watch them all over again, even rainbow bright. And for lunch, I'm going to order 3 bacon cheeseburgers and eat one cold at 3 o'clock. Maybe skip rainbow bright and take a nap. Stay in tonight. Go to bed early. And stand it off. Bobby Anderson tripped over a 3-inch tongue of metal protruding from the earth. Jim Gardner tripped over Ron Cummings. Different objects, same result. For want of a nail. Ron popped in around the same time that, some 210 miles away, Anderson and Peter were finally getting home from their less-than-normal trip to the vets. Cummings suggested they go down to the hotel bar and have a drink or 10. Or, Ron continued brightly, we could just skip the foreplay and get shit-faced. If he had put it more delicately, Gard might have been okay. Instead, he found himself in the bar with Ron Cummings, raising a jolly Jack Daniels to his lips and telling himself the old one about how he could choke it off when he really wanted to. Ron Cummings was a good, serious poet who just happened to have money practically falling out of his asshole, or so he often told people. I am my own de Medici, he would say. I have money practically falling out of my asshole. His family had been in textiles for roughly 900 years and owned most of southern New Hampshire. They thought Ron was crazy, but because he was the second son and because the first one was not crazy, i.e. uninterested in textiles, they let Ron do what he wanted to do, which was write poems, read poems, and drink almost constantly. He was a narrow young man with a TB face. Gardner had never seen him eat anything but beer nuts and goldfish crackers. To his dubious credit, he had no idea of Gardner's own problem with booze, or the fact that he had once come very close to killing his wife while drunk. "Okay," Gardner said, "I'm up for it. Let's get faced." After a few in the hotel bar, Ron suggested that a couple of smart fellows like them could find a place with entertainment a tad more exciting than the piped-in muzak drifting down from the overhead speakers. "I think my heart can take it," Ron said. "I mean, I'm not sure, but—" "God hates a coward," Gardner finished. Ron cackled, clapped him on the back, and called for the tab. He signed it with a flourish and then added a generous tip from his money clip. "Let's boogie, my man," and off they went. The late afternoon sun lanced Gardner's eyes like glass spears, and it suddenly occurred to him that this might be a bad idea. "Listen, Ron," he said, "I think maybe I'll just—" Cummings clapped him on the shoulder, formerly pale cheeks flushed, formerly watery blue eyes blazing. To Gard, Cummings now looked rather like the Toad of Toad Hall after the acquisition of his motor car, and cajoled, "Don't crap out of me now, Jim. Boston lies before us, so various anew, glistening like the fresh ejaculate of a young boy's first wet dream." Gardner burst into helpless gales of laughter. "That's more like the Gardner we've all come to know and love," Ron said, cackling himself. "God hates a coward," Gard said. "Hail us a cab, Ronnie." He saw it then, the funnel in the sky, big and black and getting closer. Soon it was going to touch down and carry him away. Not to Oz, though. A cab pulled over to the curb. They got in. The driver asked them where they wanted to go. "Oz," Gardner muttered. Ron cackled. "What he means is some place where they drink fast and dance faster. Think you can manage that?" "Oh, I think so," the driver said, and pulled out. Gardner draped an arm around Ron's shoulders and cried, "Let the wild rumpus start." "I'll drink to that," Ron said. 2. Gardner awoke the next morning fully dressed in a tub full of cold water. His best set of clothes, which he'd had the misfortune to be wearing when he and Ron Cummings set sail the day before, were bonding themselves slowly to his skin. He looked at his fingers and saw they were very white and very pruny. Fish fingers. He'd been in here for a while, apparently. The water might even have been hot when he climbed in. He didn't remember. He opened the tub drain, saw a bottle of bourbon standing on the toilet seat. It was half full, its surface bleary with some sort of grease. He picked it up,
The grease smelled vaguely of fried chicken. Gardner was more interested in the aroma coming from inside the bottle. "Don't do this," he thought. But the neck of the bottle was rapping against his teeth before the thought was even half finished. He had a drink. Blacked out again. When he came to, he was standing naked in his bedroom, with the phone to his ear and the vague idea that he had just finished dialing a number. Whose? He had no idea, until Cummings answered. Cummings sounded even worse than Gardner felt. Gardner would have sworn this was impossible. "How bad was it?" Gardner heard himself ask. It was always this way when he was in the grip of the cyclone. Even when he was conscious, everything seemed to have the gray, grainy texture of a tabloid photograph, and he never seemed to exactly be inside of himself. A lot of the time he seemed to be floating above his own head, like a kid's silvery puffer balloon. "How much trouble did we get into?"
"Trouble?"
Cummings repeated, and then fell silent. At least Gardner thought he was thinking, hoped he was thinking, or maybe dreaded the idea. He waited, his hands very cold.
"No trouble," Cummings said at last, and Gard relaxed a little. "Except for my head, that is. I got my head in plenty of trouble. Jesus!"
"You sure? Nothing? Nothing at all?" He was thinking of Nora.
"Shot your wife, huh?"
A voice spoke up suddenly in his mind, the voice of the deputy with the comic book.
"Good fucking deal."
"Well," Cummings said reflectively and then stopped. Gardner's hand clenched tight on the phone again.
"Well, what?"
Suddenly the lights in the room were too bright, like the sun when they had stepped out of the hotel late yesterday afternoon. "You did something. You had another fucking blackout and did another stupid thing, or crazy thing, or horrible thing. When are you going to learn to leave it alone? Or can you learn?" An exchange from an old movie clanged stupidly into his mind. "Evil El Comandante. Tomorrow before daybreak, senor, you will be dead. You have seen the sun for the last time." "Brave Americano." "Yeah, but you'll be bald for the rest of your life."
"What was it?"
he asked Ron. "What did I do?"
"You got into an argument with some guys at a place called the Stone Country Bar and Grill," Cummings said. He laughed a little.
"Ow! Christ, when it hurts to laugh, you know you abused yourself. You remember the Stone Country Bar and Grill and them thar good old boys, James, my dear?"
He said he didn't. Really straining, he could remember a place called Smith Brothers. The sun had just been going down in a kettle of blood, and this being late June, that meant it had been, what, 8:30, quarter of nine? About 5 hours after he and Ron had gotten started, give or take. He could remember the sign outside bore the likeness of the famous Cough Drop siblings. He could remember arguing furiously about Wallace Stevens with Cummings, shouting to be heard over the juke, which had been thundering out something by John Fogarty. That was where the last jagged edges of memory came to a halt.
"It was the place with the Waylon Jennings for President bumper sticker over the bar," Cummings said. "That refreshed the old noggin?"
"No," Gardner said miserably.
"Well, you got into an argument with a couple of the good old boys. Words were passed. These words grew first warm and then hot. A punch was thrown."
"By me?" Gardner's voice was now only dull.
"By you," Cummings agreed cheerfully. "At which point we flew through the air with the greatest of ease, landing on the sidewalk. I thought we got off pretty cheap, to tell you the truth. You had them frothing, Jim."
"Was it about Seabrook or Chernobyl?"
"Shit, you do remember."
"If I remembered, I wouldn't be asking you which one it was."
"As a matter of fact, it was both."
Cummings hesitated.
"Are you all right, Gard?" You sound real low.
Yeah. Well, actually, Ron, I'm way up. Up in the cyclone, going around and around and up and down, and where it ends, nobody knows.
I'm okay. That's good. One hopes you know who you have to thank for it.
You, maybe?
None other. Man, I landed on that sidewalk like a kid hitting the ground for the first time he comes off the end of a slide. I can't quite see my ass in the mirror, but that's probably a good thing. I bet it looks like a Dayglow Grateful Dead poster from 69. But you wanted to go back in and talk about how all the kids around Chernobyl were going to be dead of leukemia in 5 years. You wanted to talk about how some guys almost blew up Arkansas looking for faulty wiring with a candle in a nuclear power plant. You said they caught the place on fire. Me, I bet my watch, and it's a Rolex, that they were Snopeses from MISSIPPI. Only way I could get you into a cab was by telling you we'd come back later and bust heads. I sweet-talked you up to your room and started the tub for you. You said you were all right. You said you were going to take a bath and then call some guy named Bobby.
The guy's a girl, Gardner said absently. He was rubbing his right temple with his free hand.
Good-looking?
Pretty. No knockout. An errant thought, nonsensical but perfectly concrete. Bobby's in trouble, kicked across his mind the way an errant billiard ball will roll across the clean green felt of a pool table. Then it was gone. 3. He walked slowly over to a chair and sat down, now massaging both temples. The nukes. Of course it had been the nukes. What else? If it wasn't Chernobyl, it was Seabrook. And if it wasn't Seabrook, it was 3 Mile Island. And if it wasn't 3 Mile Island, it was Maine Yankee and was Cassett. Or what could have happened at the Hanford plant in Washington State if someone hadn't happened to notice, just in the nick of time, that their used core rods, stored in an unlined ditch outside, were getting ready to blow sky high? How many nicks of time could there be? Spent fuel rods that were stacking up in big hot piles. They thought the curse of King Tut was bad? Brother, wait until some 25th century archaeologist dug up a load of this shit. You tried to tell people the whole thing was a lie. Nothing but a bald-faced, naked lie. That nuclear-generated power was eventually going to kill millions and render huge tracts of land sterile and unlivable. What you got back was a blank stare. You talked to people who had lived through one administration after another in which their elected officials told one lie after another, then lied about the lies. And when those lies were found out, the liar said, "Oh, geez, I forgot. Sorry." And since they forgot, the people who elected them behaved like Christians and forgave. You couldn't believe there were so many fucking many of them willing to do that until you remembered what P.T. Barnum said about the extraordinarily high birth rate of suckers. They looked you square in the face when you tried to tell them the truth and informed you that you were full of shit. The American government didn't tell lies. Not telling lies was what made America great. Oh, dear Father, here's the facts. I did it with my little axe. I can't keep silent, for it was I, and come what may, I cannot tell a lie. When you tried to talk to them, they looked at you as if you were babbling in a foreign language. It had been 8 years since he had almost killed his wife, and 3 since he and Bobby had been arrested at Seabrook, Bobby on the general charge of illegal demonstration, Guard on a much more specific one, possession of a concealed and unlicensed handgun. The others paid a fine and got out. Gardner did 2 months. His lawyer told him he was lucky. Gardner asked his lawyer if he knew he was sitting on a time bomb and jerking his meat. His lawyer asked him if he had considered psychiatric help. Gardner asked his lawyer if he had ever considered getting stuffed. But he had had sense enough not to attend any more demonstrations. That much, anyway. He kept away from them. They were poisoning him. When he got drunk, however, his mind, whatever the booze had left of it, returned obsessively to the subject of the reactors, the core rods, the containments, the inability to slow down a runaway once it really got going. To nukes, in other words. When he got drunk, his heart got hot.
The nukes. The goddamn nukes. It was symbolic. Yeah, okay. You didn't have to be Freud to figure that what he was really protesting was the reactor in his own heart. When it came to matters of restraint, James Gardner had a bad containment system. There was some technician inside who should have long since been fired. He sat and played with all the wrong switches. That guy wouldn't be really happy until Jim Gardner went China syndrome. The goddamn fucking nukes. Forget it. He tried. For a start, he tried thinking about tonight's reading at Northeastern. A fun-filled frolic that was being sponsored by a group that called itself the Friends of Poetry, a name which filled Gardner with fear and trembling. Groups with such names tended to be made up exclusively of women who called themselves ladies, most of them of a decidedly blue-haired persuasion. The ladies of the club tended to be a good deal more familiar with the works of Rod McEwen than those of John Barrowman, Hart Crane, Ron Cummings, or that other good old drunken blackout brawler and wife-shooter, James Eric Gardner. Get out of here, Gard. Never mind the New England Poetry Caravan. Never mind Northeastern or the Friends of Poetry or the McCardle bitch. Get out of here right now before something bad happens, something really bad. Because if you stay, something really bad will. There's blood on the moon. But he was damned if he'd go running back to Maine with his tail between his legs. Not him. Besides, there was the bitch. Patricia McCardle was her name, and if she wasn't one strutting world-class bitch, Gard had never met one. She had a contract, and it specified no play, no pay. Jesus, Gardner said, and put a hand over his eyes, trying to shut away the growing headache, knowing there was only one kind of medicine that would do that, and also knowing it was exactly the sort of medicine that could bring that really bad thing on. And also knowing that knowing would do no good at all. So, after a while, the booze started to flow and the cyclone started to blow. Jim Gardner, now in freefall. 4. Patricia McCardle was the New England Poetry Caravan's principal contributor and head ramrod. Her legs were long but skinny, her nose aristocratic but too blade-like to be considered attractive. Gard had once tried to imagine kissing her, and had been horrified by the image which had risen unbidden in his mind. Her nose not just sliding up his cheek, but slicing it open like a razor blade. She had a high forehead, non-existent breasts, and eyes as gray as a glacier on a cloudy day. She traced her ancestry back to the Mayflower. Gardner had worked for her before, and there had been trouble before. He had become part of the 1988 New England Poetry Caravan in rather grisly fashion, but the reason for his abrupt inclusion was no more unheard of in the world of poetry than it was in those of jazz and rock and roll. Patricia McCardle had been left with a last-minute hole in her announced program because one of the six poets who had signed on for this summer's happy cruise had hung himself in his closet with his belt. Just like Phil Ox, Ron Cummings had said to Gardner as they sat near the back of the bus on the first day of the tour. He said it with a nervous bad boy at the back of the classroom giggle. But then, Bill Clotsworth always was a derivative son of a bitch. Patricia McCardle had gotten 12 reading dates and fairly good advances on a deal which, when stripped of all the high-flown rhetoric, boiled down to 6 poets for the price of 1. Following Clotsworth's suicide, she found herself with 3 days to find a publishing poet in a season when most publishing poets were booked solid, or on permanent vacation, like Silly Billy Clotsworth, Cummings said, laughing rather uneasily. Few, if any, of the booked groups would balk at paying the stipulated fee just because the caravan happened to be short one poet. To do such a thing would be in rather shitty taste, particularly when one considered the reason the caravan was a poet short. All the same, it put Caravan, Inc. in a position of contractual default, at least technically, and Patricia McCardle was not a woman to brook loopholes. After trying 4 poets, each more minor league than the last, and with only 36 hours before the first reading, she had finally called Jim Gardner.
"Are you still drinking, Jimmy?" she asked bluntly.
Jimmy, he hated that. Most people called him Jim. Jim was all right. No one called him guard except himself and Bobby Anderson.
"Drinking a little," he said, "not binging at all."
"I'm dubious," she said coldly.
"You always have been, Patty," he replied, knowing she hated that even more than he did Jimmy. Her Puritan blood screamed against it.
"Were you asking because you happened to be short at court, or did you have a more pressing reason?"
Of course he knew, and of course she knew he knew, and of course she knew he was grinning, and of course she was infuriated, and of course all this tickled him just about to death, and of course she knew he knew that, too, and that was just the way he liked it. They sparred a few more minutes, and then came to what was not a marriage of convenience, but one of necessity. Gardner wanted to buy a good used wood furnace for the coming winter. He was tired of living like a slut, bundled up at night in front of the kitchen stove while the wind rattled the plastic stapled over the windows. Patricia McCardle wanted to buy a poet. There would be no handshake agreement, though, not with Patricia McCardle. She had driven down from Derry that afternoon with a contract, in triplicate, and a notary public. Guard was a little surprised she hadn't brought a second notary, just in case the first one happened to suffer a coronary or something. Feelings and hunches aside, there was really no way he could leave the tour and get the wood furnace, because if he left the tour, he would never see the second half of his fee. She'd haul him into court and spend $1,000 trying to get him to cough up the 300 Caravan Inc. had paid him up front. She might be able to do it, too. He had done almost all the dates, but the contract he had signed was crystal clear on the subject. If he took off, for any reason unacceptable to the tour coordinator, any and all fees unpaid shall be declared null and void, and any and all fees prepaid shall be refundable to Caravan Inc. within 30 days. And she would go after him. She might think she was doing it on principle, but it would really be because he had called her Patty in her hour of need. Nor would that be the end of it. If he left, she would work with unflagging energy to get him blackballed. He would certainly never read again for another poetry tour with which she was associated, and that was a lot of poetry tours. Then there was the delicate matter of grants. Her husband had left her a lot of money, although he didn't think you could say, as Ron Cummings did, that she practically had money falling out of her asshole, because Gard didn't believe Patricia McCardle had anything so vulgar as an asshole, or even a rectum. When in need of relief, she probably performed an act of immaculate excretion. Patricia McCardle had taken a great deal of this money and set up a number of grants in aid. This made her simultaneously a serious patron of the arts and an extremely smart businesswoman in regard to the nasty business of income taxes. The grants were write-offs. Some of them funded poets for specific time periods. Some funded cash poetry awards and prizes, and some underwrote magazines of modern poetry and fiction. The grants were administered by committees. Behind each of them moved the hand of Patricia McCardle, making sure that they meshed as neatly as the pieces of a Chinese puzzle, or the strands of a spider's web. She could do a lot more to him than get back her lousy $600. She could muzzle him. And it was just possible, unlikely but possible, that he might write a few more good poems before the madmen who had stuffed a shotgun up the asshole of the world decided to pull the trigger.
"So get through it," he thought.
He had ordered a bottle of Johnny Walker from room service. God bless the tab forever and ever, amen. And now he poured his second drink with a hand that had become remarkably steady. Get through it, that's all. But as the day wore on, he kept thinking about grabbing a Greyhound bus at the Stewart Street terminal and getting off 5 hours later in front of the dusty little drugstore in Unity, thumbing a ride up to Troy from there, calling Bobby Anderson on the phone and saying, "I almost went up in the cyclone, Bobby, but I found the storm cellar just in time. Lucky break, huh?" "Shit on that. You make your own luck. If you be strong, guard, you be lucky. Get through it, that's all. That's what to do."
He scrummed through his tote bag, looking for the best clothes he had left, since his reading clothes appeared to be beyond salvage. He tossed a pair of faded jeans, a plain white shirt, a tattered pair of skivvies, and a pair of socks onto the bedspread.
"Thanks, ma'am,
But there's no need to make up the room. I slept in the tub. He got dressed, ate some certs, ate some booze, ate some more certs, and then went through the bag again, this time looking for the aspirin. He found it and ate some of those. He looked at the bottle, looked away. The pulse of the headache was getting worse. He sat down by the window with his notebooks, trying to decide what he should read that night. In this dreadful long afternoon light, all his poems looked as if they had been written in Punic. Instead of doing anything positive about his headache, the aspirin seemed to actually be intensifying it. Slam! Bam! Thank you, ma'am. His head whacked with each heartbeat. It was the same old headache, the one that felt like an auger made of dull steel being slowly driven into his head at a point slightly above and to the left of his left eye. He touched the tips of his fingers to the faint scar there and ran his fingers lightly along it. The steel plate buried under the skin there was the result of a skiing accident in his teens. He remembered the doctor saying, "You may suffer headaches from time to time, son. When they come, just thank God you can feel anything. You're lucky to be alive." But at times like this, he wondered. Times like this, he wondered a lot. He put the notebooks aside with a shaking hand and closed his eyes. "I can't get through it." "You can." "I can't. There's blood on the moon. I feel it. I can almost see it." "Don't give me any of your Irish willy-wags. Just get tough, you weak fucking sister. Tough!" "I'll try," he muttered, not opening his eyes. And 15 minutes later, when his nose began to bleed slightly, he didn't notice. He had fallen asleep in the chair. 5. He always got stage fright before reading, even if the group was a small one, and groups which turned out to hear readings of modern poetry tended to be just that. On the night of June 27th, however, Jim Gardner's stage fright was intensified by his headache. When he woke from his nap in the hotel room chair, the shakes and the fluttery stomach were gone, but the headache had gotten even worse. It had graduated to a genuine Class A thumper and world-beater, maybe the worst of all time. When his turn to read finally came, he seemed to hear himself from a great distance. He felt a little like a man listening to a recording of himself on a shortwave broadcast coming in from Spain or Portugal. Then a wave of lightheadedness coursed through him, and for a few moments he could only pretend to be looking for a poem, some special poem, perhaps, that had been temporarily misplaced. He shuffled papers with dim and nerveless fingers, thinking, "I'm going to faint, I think, right up here in front of everyone, fall against this lectern, and pitch both it and me into the front row. Maybe I can land on that blue-blooded cunt and kill her. That would almost make my whole life seem worthwhile." "Get through it," that implacable inner voice responded. Sometimes that voice sounded like his father's. More often it sounded like the voice of Bobby Anderson. "Get through it, that's all. That's what to do." The audience that night was larger than usual. Maybe 100 people squeezed behind the desks of a northeastern lecture hall. Their eyes seemed too big. "What big eyes you have, Grandma." It was as if they would eat him up with their eyes, suck out his soul, his ka, his whatever you wanted to call it. A snatch of old T-Rex occurred to him. Of course, there was no more T-Rex. Mark Bolan had wrapped his sports car around a tree and was lucky not to be alive. "Bang a gong, Mark. You sure got it on. Or got it off, or whatever. A group called Power Station is going to cover your tune in 1986, and it's going to be really bad. It... He raised an unsteady hand to his forehead, and a quiet murmur ran through the audience. "Better get going, guard. Natives are getting restless." Yeah, that was Bobby's voice, all right. The fluorescence, embedded in pebbled rectangles overhead, seemed to be pulsing in cycles which perfectly matched the cycles of pain driving into his head. He could see Patricia McCardle. She was wearing a little black dress that surely hadn't cost a penny more than $300, distress sale stuff from one of those tacky little shops on Newbury Street. Her face was as narrow and pallid and unforgiving as that of any of her Puritan forebears, those wonderful, fun-loving guys who had been more than happy to stick you in some stinking jail for 3 or 4 weeks if you had the bad luck to be spied on going out on the Sabbath day without a snot rag in your pocket. Patricia's dark eyes lay upon him like dusty stones, and Guard thought, "She sees what's happening, and she couldn't be more pleased. Look at her. She's waiting for me to fall down. And when I do, you know what she'll be thinking, don't you?" Of course he did. "That's what you get for calling me Patty, you drunken son of a bitch." That was what she would be thinking. "That's what you get for calling me Patty. That's what you get for doing everything but making me get down on my knees and beg. So go on, Gardner. Maybe I'll even let you keep the upfront money. $300 seems a cheap enough price to pay for the exquisite pleasure of watching you crack up in front of all these people. Go on. Go on and get it over with." Some members of the audience were becoming visibly uneasy now. The delay between poems had stretched out far beyond what might be considered normal. The murmur had become a muted buzz. Gardner heard Ron Cummings clear his throat uneasily behind him. "Get tough," Bobby's voice yelled again. But the voice was fading now, fading. Getting ready to high-side it. He looked at their faces and saw only pasty-pale blank circles, ciphers, big white holes in the universe. The buzz was growing. He stood at the podium swaying noticeably now, wetting his lips, looking at his audience with a kind of numb dismay. And then, suddenly, instead of hearing Bobby, Gardner actually saw her. This image had all the force of vision. Bobby was up there in Haven, up there right now. He saw her sitting in a rocking chair, wearing a pair of shorts and a halter top over what boobs she had, which wasn't much. There was a pair of battered old mocks on her feet, and Peter was curled before them, deeply asleep. She had a book, but wasn't reading it. It lay open, face down in her lap. This fragment of vision was so perfect, Gardner could even read the book's title. It was Watchers by Dean Kuntz. While Bobby looked out the window into the dark, thinking her own thoughts, thoughts which would follow one after the other as sanely and rationally as you could want a train of thought to run. No derailments, no late freights, no head-ons. Bobby knew how to run a railroad. He even knew what she was thinking about, he discovered. Something in the woods, something. It was something she had found in the woods. Yes. Bobby was in Haven, trying to decide what that thing might be and why she felt so tired. She was not thinking about James Eric Gardner, the noted poet, protester, and Thanksgiving wife-shooter, who was currently standing in a lecture hall at Northeastern University under these lights with 5 other poets and some fat shit named Arberg or Argelbargel or something like that, and getting ready to faint. Here, in this lecture hall, stood the master of disaster. God bless Bobby, who had somehow managed to keep her shit together while all about her people were losing theirs. Bobby was up there in Haven, thinking the way people were supposed to think. No, she's not. She's not doing that at all. Then, for the first time, the thought came through with no soundproofing around it. It came through as loud and urgent as a fireball in the night. Bobby's in trouble. Bobby's in real trouble. This surety struck him with the force of a roundhouse slap, and suddenly the lightheadedness was gone. He fell back into himself with such a thud he almost seemed to feel his teeth rattle. A sickening bolt of pain ripped through his head, but even that was welcome. If he felt pain, then he was back here. Here, not drifting around someplace in the ozone. And for one puzzling moment he saw a new picture, very brief, very clear, and very ominous. It was Bobby in the cellar of the farmhouse she had inherited from her uncle. She was hunkered down in front of some piece of machinery, working on it. Or was she? It seemed so dark, and Bobby wasn't much of a hand with mechanical stuff. But she sure was doing something, because ghostly blue fire leapt and flickered between her fingers as she fiddled with tangled wires inside, but it was too dark to see what that dark cylindrical shape was. It was familiar, something he had seen before, but then he could hear as well as see, although what he heard was even less comforting than that eldritch blue fire. It was Peter. Peter was howling. Bobby took no notice,
and that was utterly unlike her. She only went on fiddling with the wires, jiggering them so they would do something down there in the root-smelling dark of the cellar. The vision broke apart on rising voices. The faces which went with those voices were no longer white holes in the universe, but the faces of real people. Some were amused, but not many. A few more embarrassed, but most just seemed alarmed or worried. Most looked, in other words, the way he would have looked had his position been reversed with one of them. Had he been afraid of them? Had he? If so, why? Only Patricia McCardle didn't fit. She was looking at him with a quiet, sure satisfaction that brought him all the way back. Gardner suddenly spoke to the audience, surprised at how natural and pleasant his voice sounded. "I'm sorry. Please excuse me. I've got a batch of new poems here, and I went wool-gathering among them, I'm afraid." Pause. Smile. Now he could see some of the worried ones settling back, looking relieved. There was a little laughter, but it was sympathetic. He could, however, see a flush of anger rising in Patricia McCardle's cheeks, and it did his headache a world of good. "Actually," he went on, "even that's not the truth. Fact is, I was trying to decide whether or not to read some of this new stuff to you. After some furious sparring between those two thundering heavyweights, Pride of Authorship and Prudence, Prudence has won a split decision. Pride of Authorship vows to appeal the decision." More laughter. Heartier. Now old Patty's cheeks looked like his kitchen stove through its little isinglass windows on a cold winter night. Her hands were locked together, the knuckles white. Her teeth weren't quite bared, but almost, friends and neighbors. Almost. "In the meantime, I'm going to finish with a dangerous act. I'm going to read a fairly long poem from my first book, Grimoire." He winked in Patricia McCardle's direction, then took them all into his humorous confidence. "But God hates a coward, right?" Ron snorted laughter behind him, and then they were all laughing, and for a moment he actually did see a glint of her pearly whites behind those stretched, furious lips. And oh boy, howdy, that was just about as good as you'd want, wasn't it? "Watch out for her, guard. You think you've got your boot on her neck now, and maybe you even do for the moment, but watch out for her. She won't forget. Or forgive." But that was for later. Now he opened the battered copy of his first book of poems. He didn't need to look for Leighton Street. The book fell open to it of its own accord. His eyes found the subscript, "For Bobby, who first smelled sage in New York." Leighton Street had been written the year he met her, the year Leighton Street was all she could talk about. It was, of course, the street in Utica where she had grown up, the street she'd needed to escape before she could even start being what she wanted to be, a simple writer of simple stories. She could do that. She could do that with flash and ease. Gard had known that almost at once. Later that year he had sensed that she might be able to do more, to surmount the careless, profligate ease with which she wrote, and do, if not great work, brave work. But first she had to get away from Leighton Street. Not the real one, but the Leighton Street which she carried with her in her mind, a demon geography populated by haunted tenements, her sick, loved father, her weak, loved mother, and her defiant crone of a sister, who rode over them all like a demon of endless power. Once that year she had fallen asleep in class, freshman comp that had been. He had been gentle with her because he already loved her a little, and he had seen the huge circles under her eyes. "I've had problems sleeping at night," she said, when he held her after class for a moment. She had still been half asleep, or she never would have gone on from there. That was how powerful Anne's hold, which was the hold of Leighton Street, had been over her. But she was like a person who has been drugged, and exists with one leg thrown over each side of the sleep's dark and stony wall. "I almost fall asleep, and then I hear her." "Who?" he asked gently. "Sissy. My sister Anne, that is. She grinds her teeth, and it sounds like b-b-b-b-bones," she wanted to say. But then she woke into a fit of hysterical weeping, and that had frightened him very badly. Anne. More than anything else, Anne was Layton Street. Anne had been, knocking at the door, the gag of Bobby's needs and ambitions. Okay, Guard thought. For you, Bobby. Only for you. And began to read Layton Street as smoothly as if he had spent the afternoon rehearsing it in his room. These streets begin where the cobbles surface through tar like the heads of children buried badly in their textures. Gardner read. What myth is this? We ask. But the children who play stickball and Johnny Jump My Pony round here just laugh. No myth, they tell us. No myth. Just, they say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street here. Ain't nothing but all small houses. Ain't only but back porches where our mothers wash there and there and there. Where days grow hot. And on Layton Street they listen to the radio, while pterodactyls flow between the TV aerials on the roof, and they say, hey, motherfucker, they say, hey, motherfucker. No myth, they tell us, no myth. Just, they say, hey, motherfucker, ain't nothing but Layton Street around here. This, they say, is how you be silent in your silence of days. Motherfucker. When we turned our back on these upstate roads, warehouses with faces of blank brick, when you say, oh, but I have reached the end of all I know and still hear her grinding, grinding in the night. Because it had been so long since he had read the poem, even to himself, he did not just perform it, something he had discovered that was almost impossible not to do at the end of a tour such as this. He rediscovered it. Most of those who came to the reading at Northwestern that night, even those who witnessed the evening's sordid, creepy conclusion, agreed that Gardner's reading of Layton Street had been the best of the night. A good many of them maintained it was the best they had ever heard, since it was the last reading Jim Gardner would ever give in his life. It was maybe not such a bad way to go out. 6. It took him nearly 20 minutes to read all of it, and when he finished, he looked up uncertainly into a deep and perfect well of silence. He had time to think he had never read the damned thing at all, that it had just been a vivid hallucination in the moment or two before the faint. Then someone stood up and began to clap steadily and hard. It was a young man with tears on his cheeks. The girl beside him also stood and began to clap, and she was also crying. Then they were all standing and applauding. Yeah, they were giving him a fucking standing O, and in their faces he saw what every poet or would-be poet hopes to see when he or she finished reading, the faces of people suddenly awakened from a dream brighter than any reality. They looked as dazed as Bobby had on that day, not quite sure where they were. But they weren't all standing and applauding, he saw. Patricia McArdle sat stiff and straight in her third-row seat, her hands clasped tightly together in her lap over her small evening bag. Her lips had closed, no sign of the old pearly whites now. Her mouth had become a small, bloodless cut. Guard felt a weary amusement. As far as you're concerned, Patty, the real Puritan ethic is no one who's a black sheep should dare rise above his designated level of mediocrity, correct? But there's no mediocrity clause in your contract, is there? Thank you, he muttered into the mic, sweeping his books and papers together into an untidy pile with his shaking hands, and then almost dropping them all over the floor as he stepped away from the podium. He dropped into his seat next to Ron Cummings with a deep sigh. My God, Ron whispered, still applauding. My God! Stop clapping, you ass, Gardner whispered back. Damned if I will. I don't care when you wrote it. It was fucking brilliant, Cummings said. And I'll buy you a drink on it later on. I'm not drinking anything stronger than club soda tonight, Gardner said, and knew it was a lie. His headache was already creeping back. Aspirin wouldn't cure that. Percodan wouldn't. Allude wouldn't. Nothing would fix his head but a great big clout of booze. Fast, fast relief. The applause was finally beginning to die away. Patricia McArdle looked acidly grateful. 7.
The name of the fat shit who had introduced each of the poets was Arberg, although Gardner kept wanting to call him Argle Bargle, and he was the assistant professor of English who headed the sponsoring group. He was the sort of man his father had called a beefy son of a whore. The beefy son of a whore threw a party for the caravan, the Friends of Poetry, and most of the English department faculty at his house after the reading. It began around 11 o'clock. It was stiffish at first, men and women standing in uncomfortable little groups with glasses and paper plates in their hands talking their usual brand of cautious academic talk. This sort of bullshit had struck Gard as a stupid waste of time when he was teaching. It still did, but there was also something nostalgic and pleasing in a melancholy way about it now. His party monster streak told him that, stiff or not, this was a party with possibilities. By midnight, the Bach etudes would almost certainly be replaced by the pretenders, and talk of classes, politics, and literature would be replaced by more interesting fare. The Red Sox, who on the faculty was drinking too much, and that all-time favorite, who was fucking whom. There was a large buffet for which most of the poets made a beeline, reliably following Gardner's first rule for touring poets. If it's gratis, grab it. As he watched, Anne Delaney, who wrote spare, haunting poems about rural working-class New England, stretched her jaws wide and ripped into the huge sandwich she was holding. Mayonnaise, the color and texture of bull semen, squirted between her fingers, and Anne licked it off her hand nonchalantly. She tipped Gardner a wink. To her left, last year's winner of Boston University's Hawthorne Prize for his long poem Harbor Dreams, 1650-1980, was cramming green olives into his mouth with blurry speed. This fellow, John Everett Symington by name, paused long enough to drop a handful of wrapped mini-wheels of Bonbel cheese into each pocket of his corduroy sport coat, patched elbows naturally, and then went back to the olives. Ron Cummings strolled over to where Gardner was standing. As usual, he wasn't eating. He had a Waterford glass that looked full of straight whiskey in one hand. He nodded toward the buffet. "Great stuff. If you're a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you in like Flynn, bo." "That Argle Bargle really knows how to live," Gardner said. Cummings, in the act of drinking, snorted so hard his eyes bulged. "You're on the hit line tonight, Jim, Argle Bargle, Jesus." He looked at the glass in Gardner's hand. It was vodka and tonic, weak, but his second just the same. "Tonic water?" Cummings asked slyly. "Well, mostly." Cummings laughed again and walked away. By the time someone pulled Bach and put on B.B. King, Gard was working on his fourth drink. On this one, he'd asked the bartender, who had been at the reading, to go a little heavier on the vodka. He had begun to repeat two remarks that seemed wittier as he got drunker. First, that if you were a connoisseur of Kirshner's bologna and iceberg lettuce, you were in like Flynn here, bo. And second, that all assistant professors were like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in at least one way. They all had secret names. Gardner confided that he had intuited that of their host, Argle Bargle. He went back for a fifth drink and told the bartender, "Just to wave the tonic bottle in that old drink's face, that would be fine." The bartender waggled the bottle of Schweppes solemnly in front of Gardner's glass of vodka. Gardner laughed until tears stood in his eyes and his stomach hurt. He really was feeling fine tonight. And who, sir or madam, deserved it more? He had read better than he had in years, maybe in his whole life. "You know," he told the bartender, a needy post-grad hired especially for the occasion, "all assistant professors are like T.S. Eliot's practical cats in one way." "Is that so, Mr. Gardner?" "Jim, just Jim." But he could see from the look in the kid's eyes that he was never going to be just Jim to this guy. Tonight he had seen Gardner blaze, and men who blazed could never be anything so mundane as just Jim. "It is," he told the kid. "Each of them has a secret name. I have intuited that of our host. It's Argle Bargle, like the sound you make when you use the old Listerine." He paused, considering. "Of which the gentleman under discussion could use a good dose, now that I think of it." Gardner laughed quite loudly. It was a fine addition to the basic thrust. Like adding a tasteful hood ornament to a fine car, he thought, and laughed again. This time a few people glanced around before going back to their conversations.
Too loud, he thought. Turn down your volume control, guard, old buddy.
He grinned widely, thinking he was having one of those magic nights. Even his damn thoughts were funny tonight. The bartender was also smiling, but his smile had a slightly concerned edge to it.
You ought to be careful what you say about Professor Arberg, he said.
Or who you say it to. He's a bit of a bear.
Oh, is he?
Gardner popped his eyes round and waggled his eyebrows energetically up and down like Groucho Marx.
Well, he's got the build for it. Beefy son of a whore, ain't he?
But he was careful to keep the old volume control down when he said it.
Yeah,
the bartender said. He looked around and then leaned over the makeshift bar toward Gardner.
There's a story that he happened to be passing by the grad assistant's lounge last year and heard one of them joking about how he'd always wanted to be associated with a school where Moby Dick wasn't just another dry classic, but an actual member of the faculty.
That guy was one of the most promising English students Northeastern has ever had, I heard, but he was gone before the semester was over. So was everyone who left. The ones who didn't laugh stayed.
Jesus Christ, Gardner said.
He had heard stories like it before, one or two that were even worse, but still felt disgusted. He followed the bartender's glance and saw Arglebargle at the buffet standing next to Patricia McCardle. Arglebargle had a stein of beer in one hand and was gesturing with it. His other hand was plowing potato chips through a bowl of clam dip and then conveying them to his mouth, which went right on talking as it slobbered them chips in. Gardner could not remember ever having seen anything quite so quintessentially disgusting. Yet the McCardle bitch's rapt attention suggested that she might at any moment drop to her knees and give the man a blowjob out of sheer adoration. Gardner thought, and the fat fuck would go right on eating while she did it, dropping potato chip crumbs and globs of clam dip in her hair.
Jesus wept, he said,
and slugged back half of his vodka sans tonic. It hardly burned at all. What burned was the evening's first real hostility, the first outrider of that mute and inexplicable rage that had plagued him almost since the time he began drinking.
Freshen this up, would you?
The bartender dumped in more vodka and said shyly,
I thought your reading tonight was wonderful, Mr. Gardner.
Gardner was absurdly touched. Layton Street had been dedicated to Bobby Anderson and this boy behind the bar, barely old enough to drink legally himself, reminded Gardner of Bobby as she had been when she first came to the university.
Thank you.
You want to be a little careful of that vodka, the bartender said. It has a way of blindsiding you. I'm in control, Gardner said and gave the bartender a reassuring wink. Visibility 10 miles to unlimited. He pushed off from the bar, glancing toward the beefy son of a whore and McCardle again. She caught him looking at her and gazed back, cool and unsmiling, her blue eyes chips of ice.
Bite my bag, you frigid bitch, he thought,
and raised his drink to her in a boorish barrel-house salute, at the same time favoring her with an insultingly wide grin.
Just tonic, right? Pure tonic.
He looked around. Ron Cummings had appeared at his side as suddenly as Satan, and his grin was properly satanic.
Bugger off, Gardner said, and more people turned around to look. Jim, old buddy, I know, turn down the volume control.
He smiled, but he could feel that pulse in his head getting harder, more insistent. It wasn't like the headaches the doctor had predicted following his accident. It didn't come from the front of his head, but rather from someplace deep in the back. And it didn't hurt. It was, in fact, rather pleasant.
You got it.
Cummings nodded almost imperceptibly toward McCardle. She's got a heavy down on you, Jim. She'd love to dump you off the tour. Don't give her a reason.
Fuck her.
You fuck her, Cummings said. Cancer, cirrhosis of the liver, and brain damage are all statistically proven results of heavy drinking. So I could reasonably expect any of them in my future, and if one of them were to come down on my head, I'd have no one to blame but myself. Diabetes, glaucoma, and premature senility all run in my family. But hypothermia of the penis, that I can do without.
Excuse me?
Gardner stood still for a moment, puzzled, watching him go. Then he got it and brayed laughter. This time the tears did not just stand in his eyes. This time they actually rolled down his cheeks. For the third time that evening, people were looking at him. A big man, in rather shabby clothes, with a glass full of what looked suspiciously like straight vodka, standing by himself and laughing at the top of his voice. "Put a lid on it," he thought. "Turn down the volume," he thought. "Hypothermia of the penis," he thought, and sprayed more laughter. Little by little, he managed to regain control. He headed for the stereo in the other room. That was where the most interesting people at a party were usually found. He grabbed a couple of canapés from a tray and swallowed them. He had a strong feeling that Argle-Bargle and McGargle-Bargle were looking at him still, and that McGargle-Bargle was giving Argle-Bargle a complete rundown on him in neat phrases, that cool, maddening little smile never leaving her face. "You didn't know? Oh, it's quite true. He shot her right through the face. She told him she wouldn't press charges if he would give her an uncontested divorce. Well, who knows if it was the right decision or not? He hasn't shot any more women, or at least not yet. But however well he might have read tonight, after that rather eccentric lapse, I mean, he is unstable, and as you can see, he's not able to control his drinking. Better watch it, guard," he thought. And for the second time that night, a thought came in a voice that was very much like Bobby's. "Your paranoia is showing. They're not talking about you, for Christ's sake." At the doorway, he turned and looked back. They were looking directly at him. He felt nasty, dismayed shock race through him. And then he forced another big, insulting grin and tipped his glass toward both of them. "Get out of here, guard. This could be bad. You're drunk."
"I'm in control. Don't worry. She wants me to leave. That's why she keeps looking at me. That's why she's telling that fat fuck all about me, that I shot my wife, that I was busted at Seabrook with a loaded gun in my pack sack. She wants to get rid of me because she doesn't think drunken, wife-shooting, commie-simp nuclear protesters should get the biggest motherfucking hand of the night. But I can be cool. No problem, baby. I'm just going to hang out, taper off on the fire water, grab some coffee, and go home early. No problem."
And although he didn't drink any coffee, didn't go home early, and didn't taper off on the fire water, he was okay for the next hour or so. He turned down the volume control every time he heard it start going up, and made himself quit every time he heard himself doing what his wife had called holding forth. "When you get drunk, Jim," she had said, "not the least of your problems is a tendency to stop conversing and start holding forth." He stayed mostly in Arberg's living room, where the crowd was younger and not so cautiously pompous. Their conversation was lively, cheerful, and intelligent. The thought of the nukes rose in Gardner's mind. At hours such as this, it always did, like a rotting body floating to the surface in response to cannon fire. At hours such as these, and at this stage of drunkenness, the certainty that he must alert these young men and women to the problem always floated up, trailing its heat of anger and irrationality like rotted waterweed. As always. The last 6 years of his life had been bad, and the last three had been a nightmare time in which he had become inexplicable to himself and scary to almost all the people who really knew him. When he drank, this rage, this terror, and most of all, this inability to explain whatever had happened to Jimmy Gardner, to explain even to himself, found outlet in the subject of the nukes. But tonight he had hardly raised the subject when Ron Cummings staggered into the parlor, his narrow, gaunt face glowing with feverish color. Drunk or not, Cummings was still perfectly able to see how the wind was blowing. He adroitly turned the conversation back toward poetry. Gardner was weakly grateful, but also angry. It was irrational, but it was there. He had been denied his fix. So, partly thanks to the tight check rein he had imposed on himself, and partly due to Ron Cummings' timely intervention, Gardner avoided trouble until Arberg's party was almost over. Another half hour, and Gardner might have avoided trouble completely, at least for that night. But when Ron Cummings began to hold forth on the beat poets with his customary cutting wit, Gardner wandered back into the dining room to get another drink, and perhaps something to nosh on from the buffet.
What followed might have been arranged by a devil with a particularly malignant sense of humor.
Once we've got Iroquois online, you'll have the equivalent of 36 full scholarships to give away, a voice on Gardner's left was saying. Gardner looked around so suddenly that he almost spilled his drink. Surely he must be imagining this conversation. It was too coincidental to be real. Half a dozen people were grouped at one end of the buffet, 3 men and 3 women. One of the couples was that world-famous vaudeville team of Argle Bargle and McCargle Bargle. The man speaking looked like a car salesman, with better taste in clothes than most of the breed. His wife stood next to him. She was pretty in a strained way, her fading blue eyes magnified by thick spectacles. Gardner saw one thing at once. He might be an alky and obsessive on this one subject, but he had always been a sharp observer, and still was. The woman with the thick spectacles was aware that her husband was doing exactly that which Nora had accused Gard himself of doing at parties, once he got drunk, holding forth. She wanted to get her husband out, but as yet couldn't see how to do it. Gardner took a second look and guessed they had been married 8 months. Maybe a year, but 8 months was a better guess. The man speaking had to be some sort of wheel with Bay State Electric. Had to be Bay State, because Bay State owned the boondoggle that was the Iroquois plant. This guy was making it sound like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and because he looked as though he really believed it, Gardner decided he must be a wheel of a rather small sort, maybe even a spare tire. He doubted if the big guys were so crazy about Iroquois. Even putting aside the insanity of nuclear power for a moment, there was the fact that Iroquois was 5 years late coming online, and the fate of 3 interconnected New England bank chains depended on what would happen when, and if, it did. They were all standing chest-deep in radioactive quicksand and trading paper. It was like some crazy game of musical chairs. Of course, the courts had finally given the company permission to begin loading hot rods the month before, and Gardner supposed that had the motherfuckers breathing a little easier. Arberg was listening with solemn respect. He wasn't a trustee of the college, but anyone above the post of instructor would know enough to butter up an emissary from Bay State Electric, even a spare tire. Big private utilities like Bay State could do a lot for a school, if they wanted to. Was Reddy Kilowatt here a friend of poetry? About as much Gard suspected as he was a friend of the neutron bomb. His wife, however, she of the thick glasses and the strained, pretty face, she looked like a friend of poetry. Knowing it was a terrible mistake, Gardner drifted over. He was wearing a pleasant, late-in-the-party, gotta-go-soon smile, but the pulse in his head was faster, centering on the left. The old helpless anger was rising in a red wave. "Don't you know what you're talking about?" was almost all that his heart could cry. There were logical arguments against nuclear power plants that he could muster, but at times like this he could only find the inarticulate cry of his heart. "Don't you know what you're talking about? Don't you know what the stakes are? Don't any of you remember what happened in Russia 2 years ago? They haven't. They can't. They'll be burying the cancer victims far into the next century. Jesus, jumped up fiddling. Christ, stick one of those used core rods up your ass for half an hour or so and tell everyone how safe nuclear power is when your turds start to glow in the dark. Jesus. Jesus! You jerks are standing here listening to this man talk as if he was sane." He stood there, drink in hand, smiling pleasantly, listening to the spare tire spout his deadly nonsense. The third man in the group was 50 or so and looked like a college dean. He wanted to know about the possibility of further organized protests in the fall. He called the spare tire Ted. Ted, the power man, said he doubted there was much to worry about. Seabrook had had its vogue, and the Arrowhead installation in Maine, but since the federal judges had started to deal out some stiff sentences for what they saw as merely hell-raising, the protesters had slowed down fast. "These groups go through targets almost as fast as they go through rock groups," he said. Arberg, McCardle, and the others laughed, all except the wife of Ted the power man. Her smile only frayed a little more. Gardner's pleasant smile remained. It felt flash-frozen onto his face. Ted the power man grew more expansive. He said it was time to show the Arabs once and for all that America and Americans didn't need them.
He said that even the most modern coal-fired generators were too dirty to be acceptable by the EPA. He said that solar power was great as long as the sun shines. There was another burst of laughter. Gardner's head thudded and whipped, whipped and thudded. His ears, tuned to an almost preternatural pitch, heard a faint crackling sound, like ice shifting, and he relaxed his hand a bare moment before it tightened enough to shatter the glass. He blinked, and Arberg had the head of a pig. This hallucination was utterly complete and utterly perfect, right down to the bristles on the fat man's snout. The buffet was in ruins, but Arberg was scavenging, finishing up the last few triscuits, spearing a final slice of salami and chunk of cheese on the same plastic toothpick, chasing them with the last potato chip crumbs. It all went into his snuffling snout, and he went on nodding all the while as Ted the Power Man explained that nuclear was the only alternative, really. "Thank God the American people are finally getting that Chernobyl business into some kind of perspective," he said. 32 people dead, it's horrible, of course, but there was an airplane crash just a month ago that killed 190-some. You don't hear people yelling for the government to shut down the airlines, though, do you? 32 dead is horrible, but it's far from the Armageddon these nuke freaks made it sound like. He lowered his voice a little. They're as nuts as the LaRouche people you see in airports, but in a way, they're worse. They sound more rational. But if we gave them what they wanted, they'd turn around a month or so later and start whining about not being able to use their blow dryers, or found out their Cuisinarts weren't going to work when they wanted to mix up a bunch of macrobiotic food. To guard, he didn't look like a man anymore. The shaggy head of a wolf poked out of the collar of his white shirt with the narrow red pinstripes. He'd looked around, pink tongue lolling, greenish-yellow eyes sparkling. Arberg squealed some sort of approval and stuffed more odd lots into his pink pig's snout. Patricia McCardle now had the smooth, sleek head of a whippet. The college dean and his wife were weasels, and the wife of the man from the electric company had become a frightened rabbit, pink eyes rolling behind thick glasses. "Oh, God, no," his mind moaned. He blinked again, and they were just people. And one thing these protesters never remember to mention at their protest rallies is just this, Ted the Power Man finished, looking around at them like a trial lawyer reaching the climax of his summation. In 30 years of peaceful nuclear power development, there has never been one single fatality as the result of nuclear power in the United States of America. He smiled modestly and tossed off the rest of his scotch. "I'm sure we'll all rest easier knowing that," the man who looked like a college dean said. "And now I think my wife and I—" "Did you know that Marie Curie died of radiation poisoning?" Gardner asked conversationally. Heads turned. "Yeah. Leukemia, induced by direct exposure to gamma rays. She was the first casualty along the death march with this guy's power plant at the end. She did a lot of research and recorded it all." Gardner looked around the suddenly silent room. "Her notebooks are locked up in a vault," he said. "A vault in Paris. It's lead-lined. The notebooks are whole, but too radioactive to touch. As for who's died here, we don't really know. The AEC and the EPA keep a lid on it." Patricia McCardle was frowning at him. With the dean temporarily forgotten, Arberg went back to scrounging along the denuded buffet table. "On the 5th of October, 1966, Gardner said, "there was a partial nuclear meltdown of the Enrico Fermi breeder reactor in Michigan." "Nothing happened," Ted the Power Man said, and spread his hands to the assembled company as if to say, "You see, QED. "No," Gardner said, "nothing did. God may know why, but my guess is no one else does. The chain reaction stopped on its own. No one knows why. One of the engineers the contractors called in took a look, smiled, and said, 'You guys almost lost Detroit.' Then he fainted." "Oh, but Mr. Gardner, that was—" Gardner held up a hand. "When you examine the cancer death stats for the areas surrounding every nuclear power facility in the country, you find anomalies. Deaths that are way out of line with the norm. That is utterly untrue, and let me finish, please.
I don't think the facts make any difference anymore, but let me finish anyway. Long before Chernobyl, the Russians had an accident at a reactor in a place called Kishtim. But Khrushchev was premier then, and the Soviets kept their lips a lot tighter. Looks like maybe they were storing used rods in a shallow ditch. Why not? As Madame Curie might have said, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Our best guess is that the core rods oxidized, only instead of creating ferrous oxide or rust the way steel rods do, these rods rusted pure plutonium. It was like building a campfire next to a tank filled with LP gas. But they didn't know that. They assumed it would be all right. They assumed. He could hear the rage filling his voice and was helpless to stop it. They assumed. They played with the lives of living human beings as if they were, well, so many dolls. And guess what happened? The room was silent. Patty's mouth was a frozen red slash. Her complexion was milky with rage.
It rained, Gardner said. It rained hard. And that started a chain reaction that caused an explosion. It was like the eruption of a mud volcano. Thousands were evacuated. Every pregnant woman was given an abortion. There was no choice involved. The Russian equivalent of a turnpike in the Kishtim area was closed for almost a year. Then, when word started to leak out that a very bad accident had happened on the edge of Siberia, the Russians opened the road again. But they put up some really hilarious signs. I've seen the photos. I don't read Russian, but I've asked four or five different people for a translation, and they all agree. It sounds like a bad ethnic joke. Imagine yourself driving along an American thruway, I-95 or I-70 maybe, and coming up on a sign that says, "Please close all windows, turn off all ventilation accessories, and drive as fast as your car will go for the next 20 miles.
Bullshit, Ted the power man said loudly.
Photographs available under the Freedom of Information Act, Guard said. If this guy was only lying, maybe I could live with it. But he and the rest of the people like him are doing something worse. They're like salesmen telling the public that cigarettes not only don't cause lung cancer, they're full of vitamin C and keep you from having colds. Are you implying 32 at Chernobyl we can verify? Hell, maybe it is only 32. We've got photos taken by American doctors which suggest there must be well over 200 already. But say 32. It doesn't change what we've learned about high rad exposure. The deaths don't all come at once. That's what's so deceiving. The deaths come in three waves. First, the people who get fried in the accident. Second, the leukemia victims, mostly kids. Third, the most lethal wave, cancer in adults 40 and over. So much cancer, you might as well go on and call it a plague. Skin cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, melanoma and bone cancer are the most common, but you also get your intestinal cancer, your bladder cancer, your brain tumors, your...
Stop! Can't you please stop?
Ted's wife cried. Hysteria lent her voice a surprising power.
I would if I could, dear, he said gently. I can't. In 1964, the AEC commissioned a study on a worst-case scenario if an American reactor one-fifth the size of Chernobyl blew. The results were so scary, the AEC buried the report. It suggested, "Shut up, Gardiner," Patty said loudly. "You're drunk."
He ignored her, fixing his eyes on the power man's wife. It suggested that such an accident in a relatively rural area of the USA, the one they picked was mid-state Pennsylvania, where Three Mile Island is, by the way, would kill 45,000 folks, rad 70% of the state, and do $17 million worth of damage.
Holy fuck, someone cried. Are you shitting?
Nope, Gardner said, never taking his eyes from the woman, who now seemed hypnotized with terror. If you multiply by five, you get 225,000 dead and $85 million worth of damage. He refilled his glass nonchalantly in the silent grave of the room, tipped it at Arberg, and drank two mouthfuls of straight vodka. Uncontaminated vodka, one hoped.
So, he finished, we're talking almost 250,000 people dead by the time the third wave dissipates around 2040.
He winked at Ted, the power man, whose lips had pulled back from his teeth. Be hard to get that many people, even on a 767, wouldn't it?
Those figures came directly out of your butt, Ted, the power man, said angrily.
Ted,
the man's wife said nervously.
She had gone dead pale, except for tiny spots of red burning high up on her cheekbones.
You expect me to stand here and listen to that party-line rhetoric?
He asked, approaching Gardner until they were almost chest-to-chest.
Do you?
At Chernobyl, they killed the kids, Gardner said.
Don't you understand that?
The ones 10 years old, the ones in utero. Most may still be alive, but they are dying right now while we stand here with our drinks in our